bakery, in which I'll be asking why it's no longer punished and often rewarded.
Sounds good. What's it called?
Everything is fake and nobody cares. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
That sounds too good to be true.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Monday, the 30th of March. This is Today with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning: President Trump has insisted negotiations with Iran are going extremely well, that more ships carrying oil will go through the Strait of Hormuz.
We're doing extremely well in that negotiation, but you never know with Iran because we negotiate with them and then we always have to blow them up.
Oil firms, shipping companies and banks, as well as the military, are to take part in talks at Downing Street on the economic impact of the war.
Also in today's programme, the government will ban addictive algorithms, says the Prime Minister. But will such a move shield young people from the perils of social media? And...
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
In the week of the hoped-for launch of Artemis 2, we'll look at the history of space travel as humans prepare to boldly go where no man or other woman has gone before. And if they need a guidebook on their travels?
By a strange coincidence, none at all is exactly how much suspicion the ape descendant Arthur Dent had that one of his closest friends was not descended from an ape, but was, in fact, from a small planet somewhere in the vicinity of Betelgeuse.
We'll be looking at some of the finest examples of space-based writing for all ages in our Easter Intergalactic Book Club. All that after the BBC News read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said negotiations with Iran are going extremely well. He said that as a sign of respect, up to 20 oil tankers would be allowed through the Strait of Hormuz. In an interview with the Financial Times, Mr. Trump also said he didn't think the Iranians would be able to defend Kharg Island, their main terminal for oil exports. The price of Brent crude remains high, trading at $115 a barrel. From Washington, Tom Bateman.
President Trump's claim that Iran was close to conceding to his demands came alongside a series of anonymous briefings from US officials about the apparent readiness of troops to carry out ground operations. Thousands of US Marines are now in the region with special forces and paratroopers on the way. The administration is making it known the president is considering anything from a raid on Iran's oil export terminal, Kharg Island, to an audacious but likely implausible operation to seize its stockpile of highly enriched uranium, which Mr. Trump calls Iran's nuclear dust. Speaking on Air Force One last night, he said Iran was ready to hand it over, and if not, it wouldn't have a country anymore. Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf, suggested Mr. Trump was using talk of negotiations as cover for planning a ground attack, saying Iran would not accept surrender and its men were waiting for the American soldiers to set them on fire.
In Australia, the government has halved duties on petrol and diesel for 3 months. Here, Sir Keir Starmer is due to host business leaders at Downing Street to discuss the impact of the war on the UK's economy. Our business editor Simon Jack reports.
Among those attending the meeting will be representatives from Shell, BP, the Lloyd's insurance market, as well as the shipping giant Maersk and banks such as Goldman Sachs and HSBC. There'll be a military briefing on the security situation in the Strait of Hormuz. Downing Street is describing it as a roundtable discussion on how the government and the private sector can work together to reduce the impact of the war on the cost of living. The Prime Minister will reiterate that the best way to do that is through de-escalation, but that is something the attendees have no control over. Separately, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will urge other G7 finance ministers to reduce their collective reliance on imported fossil fuels. Her solution is to press ahead with more renewables and nuclear, a different message than the opposition leader Kemi Badenoch will take to Scotland. She will put the emphasis on more North Sea oil and gas drilling, which she accepts may have little impact on prices, but may give you more jobs and tax revenue to spend on any interventions needed to help households.
The boss of Travelodge has said the hotel chain is looking at how it can make further changes to protect customers after a woman was sexually assaulted by a man who was given a key card to her room by staff. In an interview with BBC Breakfast, the chief executive, Joy Boydell, insisted that guests were safe in its hotels. Lee Milner reports.
In her interview, Jo Boydell again apologised to the victim and acknowledged the company had made mistakes. Kieran Smith managed to get hold of a key card before carrying out the sexual assault at the Travelodge Hotel in Berkshire in December 2022. He was jailed in February for 7.5 years. The victim says it's taken the company far too long to introduce changes and wants Travelodge to take full accountability for what happened. Jo Boydell said an independent review would now examine Travelodge's room security procedures to make sure guests were safer when staying at its hotels.
One of Australia's biggest manhunts has ended with the killing of a gunman who'd been on the run for 7 months. Desi Freeman was wanted in connection with the deaths of two police officers in Victoria. He was shot after refusing to surrender in a 3-hour standoff at a remote property. The final details of the compensation scheme for drivers' missold car finance agreements will be published by the Financial Conduct Authority this afternoon. It's previously said 14 million deals, nearly half of the total between 2007 and 2024, were unfair. Here's our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
Some discretionary commission arrangements between lenders and dealers, a practice that's now banned, left customers paying too much for loans. Today, the regulator will publish its final decision on a central compensation scheme that could total more than £8 billion. But lenders described earlier draft plans from the FCA as too broad and too generous. They and claims management companies may still challenge the regulator's final plan, leading to an even longer wait for payouts to begin.
A new child-focused approach to legal disputes between parents has been hailed as the most significant change to family courts in 30 years. The assessment has been made by Sir Andrew McFarlane, who's stepping down as president of the Family Division. A pilot scheme is now being extended across England and Wales. Here's Sancha Berg.
Sir Andrew McFarlane said the new child-focused court turned the traditional approach to parental disputes on its head. Instead of starting with the parents' accounts, a case will now begin with the child. A social worker will interview them and their parents and write a report for the family judge. Once in court, the parents will be urged to consider the impact their dispute is having and to agree a way forward, avoiding a lengthy court battle. Sir Andrew McFarlane welcomed the government's decision to fund the scheme nationwide, but the Association of Lawyers for Children warned far more money would be needed to achieve a genuine transformational change.
And Italian police say it took just under 3 minutes for a masked gang to break into a museum near the city of Parma and steal paintings by Cézanne, Matisse and Renoir. The theft at the Magnani Rocca Foundation happened a week ago. The three pictures are estimated to have a combined value of just under £8 million.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past six is the time. Let us turn to the weather. It comes this morning from Stav Danaos at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Stav.
Good morning to you, Justin and Nick. Thank you very much. Well, this upcoming week looks very mixed once again. We're starting off on a more settled note as high pressure builds in and brings some very mild weather to our shores, particularly when we get any sunshine on Tuesday and even into Wednesday for England and Wales. But after Wednesday, we'll start to see a weather front pushing into Scotland, Northern Ireland. That'll bring a drop in temperature, outbreaks of rain. We'll see a return to some winteriness on the hills, and then the run-up as we head into the Easter weekend. Low pressure, I think, will dominate thanks to an active jet that will bring some wet and at times very windy weather with gales in the north and west and scattered showers, which will be wintry on the hills, but there will be some sunshine around too. Today, though, much of Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern and Eastern England will start off windy with further blustery showers. These have been quite heavy through the night as well, containing hail, some snow, especially on the hills in Scotland. Much of Wales, the Midlands, Southern England, starting day dry with some sunny spells, but all areas will see strong northwesterly winds. These will start to ease down through the day as high pressure begins to build in. So today it does stay windy for the northeast of Scotland and the northern hours, where you have further blustery showers, gale force northwesterly winds. But elsewhere, the rest of Scotland, Northern Ireland, England, Wales, you'll see those northwesterly winds begin to ease down, and it'll turn drier, increasing amounts of sunshine as well. So it is an improving sort of day, a better afternoon than how the day's starting. Temperature-wise, we're looking at 9 to 12 degrees from north to south across the UK, which is around average. I'll have more for you later.
Yes, you had more if I hadn't interrupted you. Apologies for that, Staff Dinesh. Thank you. Look forward to hearing from you as the programme proceeds. It's now 9 minutes past six. Let's take a look at the morning papers. The Telegraph reports that the NHS is to, in its words, ration hospital referrals as part of efforts by the government to cut waiting lists. GPs have apparently been ordered to consult on at least a quarter of their referrals, rather than sending people to hospital. Experts fear the move will be awful for patients. An NHS spokesperson has told the paper the approach will help support clinical decision making. The Guardian says its own analysis of NHS data shows the health service in England is set to miss key targets for treatment, leaving patients facing persistently long delays.
Photographs of three children who were killed in the opening day of the US-Israeli war in Iran feature on the front page of The Guardian. The paper's spoken to a number of families who were caught up in the attack. A month on, they describe feeling numb and as if there is nothing left.
According to The Times, just 10 doctors have prescribed more than half of all cannabis drugs since they were legalised for medical use in the UK in 2019. The paper says there are concerns that some clinics may have been set up to prescribe patients with what they say they want, irrespective of whether there's any evidence that cannabis can help with their complaint. The Department for Health said it expected regulators to crack down on private clinics that prescribe without the prior research required.
The Eye reports that talks between the UK and the EU over a visa mobility scheme for the under-30s have reached a deadlock. Brussels is said to be resisting Britain's demands for what the paper calls a hard limit on the number of young people who can take part. The Financial Times says the EU has offered an emergency brake to control any surge in numbers.
Broken in Britain is the Sun's headline, as it says police failed to solve 92% of burglaries in Britain last year. Experts argue that break-ins have become effectively decriminalised. The Home Office is quoted as saying its recently announced policing reforms will allow local forces to focus on crimes such as burglary.
11 minutes past six is the time. The Israeli military says it's been responding to missiles launched from Iran with attacks of its own on targets in Iran in recent hours. Let's talk to Azadeh Mashir, who's our correspondent in Doha. What can you tell us, Azadeh?
Well, so it does feel like there are these two tracks that are going on. On the one hand, you have a diplomatic route with leaders gathering in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt. But then on the other, there is all this talk of potential escalation and ground operations. In the meantime, here in the Gulf, you have countries that are still receiving these sustained attacks from Iran. Iran is saying that these are reprisals. And we were woken in the night to the sound of an explosion here in Dubai, and authorities have said that the sound of explosions across the city were the sounds of interceptions. That's been daily life here. In Kuwait, the power and water desalination plant was targeted, according to authorities there. An Indian national was killed in that attack. And aluminium plants have been attacked in Bahrain and the UAE over the weekend. So major infrastructure is still very much in Iran's sights here. And the way of life is being attacked. That's why leaders here are insisting that they have to have a say in any future talks, but it's just unclear whether that's the track that gets chosen.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Sorry, I thought you were in Doha, but you're actually not. You're in Dubai. But for all of those Gulf states, do we have a sense now of whether they are separately thinking of what the way forward should be, or are they coming together?
It's a really good point, because the fact is they don't all speak with one voice and they certainly don't see things the same way. And you have opposite ends of the spectrum. Bahrain and the UAE in the past few weeks are the only two in the Gulf that have signed a joint statement alongside Western nations saying that they'll cooperate and commit to efforts as a group to secure the Strait of Hormuz. Obviously, that shipping lane is really important to countries here, given 20% of the world's oil passes through there. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have Oman, which has very publicly rebuked the United States, really the only one to have said it so forcefully. They even at one point, the foreign minister wrote an op-ed publicly in The Economist saying the US had lost control of its foreign policy. And so they are furious that the United States left the diplomatic option in the first place, left negotiations. The UAE, though, and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia have been quite vocal that the way they see this going is that the relationship with Iran is no longer are about coexistence and that it has to fundamentally change. And so they want a curb not only on nuclear power, but also on missiles and banks that Iran has clearly been very willing to use against countries, even countries that have been mediating forces in the past. None of them has openly said they're looking at military options themselves. They've not said that publicly, and they're all publicly saying that they're still open to a diplomatic route, but they're not acting as one entity here, and that it is a problem when they're considering the security of the entire region.
Azadeh Mashiri, our correspondent in Dubai, thank you.
It's now 14 minutes past six. Police are continuing to question a man arrested on suspicion of attempted murder in Derby after a car hit and injured seven people in the city centre on Saturday evening. Our Midlands reporter Amy Cole joins us. What more are the police telling us, Amy?
Well, at the moment, Nick, it's very calm here. The corn's gone and businesses are preparing to reopen. They had to remain closed for several hours yesterday while forensic teams were on the scene. There's actually no hint of the horror that unfolded on Saturday night. I'm in Friargate, which is one of the most popular areas for a night out. But that good time feeling came to an abrupt end when a car ploughed into pedestrians at around 9:30 p.m. So it was very, very busy. Seven people were seriously injured and taken to hospital. Their injuries aren't thought to be life-threatening. Well, one eyewitness told the BBC that he saw people lying injured in the road and there were a lot of police and ambulances. Another said that she heard screaming and shouting. Well, Derbyshire police, as you say, have arrested and are continuing to question a 36-year-old man on suspicion of attempted murder in connection to the incident. Officers have revealed that he is of Indian national, but he's lived in the UK for a number of years. Now, counter-terrorism officers are assisting with the investigation, although the force confirmed during a press conference held yesterday that it doesn't mean the incident is being treated as terrorism, but it's common practice for an incident of this nature. We also learned that officers were on the scene within seconds and an arrest took place 7 minutes later, thanks in part to the many eyewitnesses who were around and contacted police.
Amy Cole in Derby, thank you.
16 minutes past six. The Prime Minister is going to meet senior business leaders today for talks on the impact of the Iran conflict on energy prices. Leanna Byrne has more on that and indeed the rest of the business news. Morning, Leanna.
Good morning. Yes, it's Brent crude, the international benchmark for oil prices, ticks up again in early trading above $115 this morning. Sir Keir Starmer will meet the senior leaders from the energy, shipping, financial and insurance sectors, as well as representatives from the UK's military to discuss the ongoing war and the impact of the Strait of Hormuz. The conflict has already led to spiralling costs and over the weekend, Houthi rebels in Yemen resumed attacking Red Sea shipping, as we heard, opening a new front in the escalating conflict. Shipping and logistics company Maersk will be in attendance. Lars Jensen is a former director there. He's now CEO of Vesputi Maritime, a container shipping consultancy. Lars, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, governments around the world are already stepping in. Australia today cutting fuel taxes. South Korea is considering restrictions on driving, widening them out. Are these the type of measures the UK government might have to look at as well?
That might have to be measures if you want to keep costs under control, because with the developments over the last few weeks in the Strait of Hormuz, it appears exceedingly unlikely that there is any short-term respite to the flow of goods through the Strait of Hormuz by commercial shipping.
Now, domestically, what can we actually do here? This is an international conflict. So we come together, have a meeting. What can be done?
In reality, not very much. There will be a lot of words, but there's very little action that can be taken, because at the end of the day, it boils down to whether or not the Iranians want to shoot at ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Any talks about, well, can we do something on insurance? Can we do something about military escorts? All of that is unlikely to lead to a massive change in the risk willingness on the part of the commercial shipping companies.
And then what we're also hearing, increasingly aggressive rhetoric from Washington about targeting Iranian oil infrastructure. What's that doing to oil prices and how is that filtering through to the UK consumer?
Yeah, oil prices have, of course, been escalating over the past month, and it would appear we would only be in the beginning of those price escalations. We need to keep in mind that a lot of the oil that was loaded in the Persian Gulf prior to this crisis is still right now arriving in some of the refineries around the world. That will soon stop. So the oil shortages that we have been seeing, they are only going to get worse, even if magically the Strait of Hormuz would reopen tomorrow.
How bad could this get from here? Are we talking about a prolonged squeeze in supply? Or is it a sudden shock that takes a significant chunk of oil off the market?
No, I mean, the problem again is the extended supply chain for oil and energy products is measured in many, many months. So as I mentioned, even if you open tomorrow, you're going to feel these higher prices at least for the next 6 months, if not even more. And that's before we take into account the facilities that have now been physically destroyed in the Persian Gulf. So we need to sit back from a global perspective and start to work around that we will face massive energy costs, not just while this crisis goes on, but also for 6 to 12 months after it's over.
Now, Lars, a lot of people are comparing this to the 1970s oil crisis. What's your take on that?
And the comparison is easy to make. The problem is it's not quite correct, because back then the amount of goods, not just oil, but also fertilizer, aluminium, all sorts of other products, it was a lot less than what we're dependent on today. So the impact we are seeing today is going to be substantially larger than what we saw back in the 70s.
That's quite stark. This is quite a stark thing to say.
Yes, indeed it is. But I think a lot of people are underestimating what the impact is. And if I may, I mean, we talk a lot about oil. What has me a lot more concerned is fertilizer. You got 20 to 30% of the seaborne fertilizer in the world originating from the Gulf. This will mean rapidly escalating food prices, especially in poorer countries, which typically tends to destabilize such countries.
Lars Jensen, CEO of Vespucci Maritime, thank you so much for joining us. With me now is Judith McKenzie. Judith, as I mentioned, Brent crude oil prices, the international benchmark, it's up over $115. I mean, aluminium stocks are also up. Asia stocks are down. Give us the full picture.
The full picture is that, well, as Lars was just saying, it's pretty gloomy. I think this week, as we're entering into the fifth week of this war, we really need to see some resolution of some sort. Otherwise, the consumer's going to feel it. Bond yields feel it. Markets feel it. So, we're really at quite a pivotal point here. And if you look at bond yields from last week, so basically bond yields is a barometer on how confident investors are feeling about a country. So the higher the yield, the less confidence investors are feeling about the country. And the UK and the USA are experiencing nearly the highest 10-year bond yields since the great financial crisis. Only the Liz Truss little episode was quite as high. So that really is a sign that investors are feeling exceptionally nervous about life for all the reasons that we've just talked about here. And the reality is that oil shocks don't show up instantly, just as Lars was saying. They hit households weeks later through food, fuel and transport costs. So we've still got quite a way to go yet. And I think, you know, I'm looking at the price of crude oil as the pricing statistic instead of indices at the moment. So it's the first thing I'm looking at.
I think we all are. Judith, I do want to put context on this, though. This is not as bad as where the oil and gas prices were at in 2022 or even at the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah, sadly, bond yields are telling us that they could get close to it. But, you know, it's all about supply demand. So if we can get some resolution in the Gulf this week, then although it's going to take a little bit of time to unwind and we will see inflation, then it's, you know, it is fixable. But, you know, this is in our power, or it's in somebody's power.
Now, last one for you. The UK should agree to regular increases in NHS drug prices and phase out a multi-billion dollar rebate scheme, rather. That's what the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly has asked for in return for it resuming investment in Britain. And Eli Lilly's president of international business, Patrick Johnson, gave the comments to the Financial Times. What do you make of that, Judith?
Well, look, this is nothing new, really. We've had US pharma in particular complaining about our NHS rebate system. So, and Eli Lilly's in quite an interesting position at the moment because they are the supplier of Mounjaro. So they've got quite a bit of negotiating power. So it's not just Eli that have been saying this. Novartis had said that the UK is becoming uninvestable and allegedly there's about $2 billion of pharma investment being delayed. So there's an element of negotiation here. And the president himself did say that he is He's optimistic that some kind of deal will be reached. And what I quite like about his approach is that he said that he's happy to be charged on outcomes. So if patients are returning to work after taking Mounjaro, he's happy to pay to be paid up. So that's quite an interesting take.
All right, Judith, really interesting. Judith McKenzie, partner and head of Downing Fund Managers, thank you so much for joining us. Now, increases to business rates and the national minimum wage are due to come into force this week, which will add £1.4 billion in sector-wide costs for businesses, according to trade body UK Hospitality. And that's a group which represents thousands of firms that, alongside those additional wage costs, business rates will be up £30,000 extra next year for hospitality businesses. Comes just ahead of the Easter break, which normally is a busy time for leisure, tourism and hospitality. I'm joined by Michael Warren, Chief Executive of Harbour Hotels, which employs over 1,300 people. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Leanne.
Now, these new rules around national insurance, minimum wage, comes into force this week, as I mentioned. How will that impact a business like yours?
Well, I mean, it has a significant impact on our business and all hospitality businesses. To put that in some context, Leanne, national insurance adjustments alone will probably be in the region of 600,000. Business rate adjustments this year from next month, equally, but perhaps 650,000. So combined, it's in excess, comfortably in excess of £1 million of a hit on the business.
Now, your sector traditionally employs a lot of young people, either in part-time work or very earlier in their career. So will those new rules cause you to rethink that?
Well, in our case, for example, with 1,300 employees, we would perhaps have 30% of our workforce that I would define as young employees, 18 to 21 year olds. And yes, it does cause businesses to reconsider their recruitment strategies. Simply that the cost of employing young people is tremendously high now. It's at an all-time high. And hospitality and perhaps also retail, traditionally, we do employ more young people than other industries. We've always been the industries that provide young people with their first work experience. And most businesses have to reconsider how they approach that. So, yes, it will have an impact.
Now, we did have a response from the government. It said, we recognise the challenges UK hospitality is facing, which is why we're cutting costs through a £4.3 billion support package to cap business rate bill hikes. Do you qualify for that support?
We partially qualify for the support, but that statement from the government is really masking what is the real scenario, that the business rates and the multiplier within them has increased significantly. So any continued transitional relief is only offsetting partially what is in fact a real terms significant increase. You mentioned at the outset that for most hospitality businesses, that would be approximately £30,000. As I said, in our case, we operate 15 hotels. It's about £600,000. So, that isn't a helpful move by the government. It's really masking what is a real term significant increase.
And quite quickly, with inflation over 3% and the war in Iran set to drive that higher, are you worried?
Well, look, we're concerned, like any other businesses. I mean, costs of doing business are at an all-time high. Energy costs are high. Some businesses have fixed energy costs. That would be a very favourable position to be in at the moment. We are seeing other trends as a result of what's happening in the Middle East. So we're seeing some positive booking trends across our hotels.
Michael, I'm glad about that. Michael Warren, Chief Executive of Harbour Hotels, thanks so much for joining us.
And Leanna, thank you. 28 minutes past six. What has the sport got to tell us this morning? Carthy's here. Morning.
I'll run you through absolutely everything or whatever I can in 2.5 minutes. 44 days and just 7 matches. That's how long Igor Tudor lasted as the interim head coach of Tottenham Hotspur. The BBC understands that Spurs want to convince Roberto De Zerbi to become their new permanent head coach. Patrick Geary has details of why Tudor and Spurs have parted ways.
Igor Tudor was brought in to make an immediate impact at Tottenham Hotspur after the departure of Thomas Frank, but he leaves with the club in 17th position in the table and just a point off the bottom three. Tudor lost 5 of his 7 matches in charge of Spurs. He did not attend his media duties after the 3-0 defeat to Nottingham Forest last Sunday, as he had just learned of the death of his father. Spurs acknowledged that loss in their statement announcing Tudor's departure and said they had mutually agreed to part ways. Now the club have to find their third manager of the season as they try to avoid being relegated from the Premier League for the first time.
A 7-goal thriller in the Women's Super League finished with Chelsea beating Aston Villa 4-3 as Chelsea move up to second place in the WSL behind Manchester City. 19-year-old Kimi Antonelli has become the youngest driver to lead Formula One's World Championship after winning the Japanese Grand Prix, but the 4-time world champion Max Verstappen says he's considering his future in the sport after an 8th place finish and a frustrating start to the season.
When you are in P7, P8 and you are not enjoying the whole formula behind it, it doesn't feel natural to a racing driver. Of course, I try to adapt to it, but yeah, it's just not what I want to do. And of course, you can look at it, yeah, make a lot of money, great. But at the end of the day, it's not about money anymore because this has always been my passion.
Golf and England's Alex Fitzpatrick. The younger brother of Matt Fitzpatrick has won his first DP World Tour title at the Indian Open a week after his brother won the Valspar Championship.
It can be hard sometimes when you're constantly chasing someone's their accolades and stuff, but luckily it's my brother. It's extremely nice to join him in the winners' ranks. I idolise him, so just trying to be like him in every way. So yeah, hopefully we can keep doing well.
Rugby Union Prem champions Bath had a 31 points to 26 win over Sale, meaning Bath are just 1 point behind leaders Northampton Saints now. In Rugby League Super League, Warrington Wolves' 100% record is over after a 26 points to 22 defeat to Leeds Rhinos. And in tennis, Jannik Sinner and Aryna Sabalenka have won the Miami Open singles titles to add to the Indian Wells titles they both won earlier this month. It's only the 4th time in history that the same two players have won what's known in tennis as the Sunshine Double.
Cathy, thank you for that. Let us hear now about some comedy coming up on Wednesday.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here.
Hi, Roger. It's Brian.
These are the voice notes of Brian and Roger.
I've had a word with Paul, and he's willing to accept the bet if you live in a bin for a week instead of me.
A dark comedy about friendship.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here. Yeah, I'll take some reading with me. I've got a sleeping bag. Yeah.
One of them is nice. One of them isn't.
Hello, Brian. Are you going to come down today? I could really do with some water and some fruit.
Brian and Roger, the cult hit comedy, comes to Radio 4 with 6 exclusive episodes starting Wednesday night at 11. Or hear the best of box set now on BBC Sounds.
Time now is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4, Justin Webb and Nick Robinson, and Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
President Trump has said the US could reach a deal with Iran fairly quickly and that America could easily take the Iranian oil terminal at Khan Island. 3,500 US ground troops have arrived in the Middle East. Israel says it's been carrying out new waves of attacks across Tehran, while Iran has continued to fire at targets in the Gulf countries. Business leaders will meet the Prime Minister today to discuss the impact of the war on the UK's economy. Downing Street said the aim of the discussions with the energy, shipping and financial services industries will be to see how the government and the private sector can work together to respond to the conflict. Travelodge's boss has said that the company would look at how they could do more to safeguard their guests after a man deceived staff to get a woman's key card and then sexually assaulted her. In an interview with BBC Breakfast, Joe Boydell apologised to the victim and said a full independent review was now taking place. Police in Australia have shot dead a man wanted for killing two of their colleagues 7 months ago. Desi Freeman was tracked to a remote property in Victoria, where he was involved in a 3-hour standoff before being shot. Millions of drivers who were missold finance agreements will find out how they will be compensated later today. The Financial Conduct Authority has previously suggested nearly half of car finance agreements made between 2007 and 2024 were unfair and eligible for compensation. And the most senior judge in the family court has called a new child-focused approach to parental disputes the most significant change to the system in 30 years. Sir Andrew McFarlane has welcomed the government's decision to extend a pilot scheme across England and Wales.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to seven. Donald Trump has been talking overnight to the Financial Times, including about Karg Island, the Iran's main oil terminal, which he seems to suggest that US troops could take. He's been talking to other people as well, as our Washington correspondent Tom Bateman has been telling me.
In the FT interview, he talks about Karg Island again and makes it clear that, well, he says he wants the oil, which is something we've heard before, obviously. But in terms of Karg Island, I think, you know, this is another nod to the fact that there is clear consideration of this as an operation to send in either paratroopers or some kind of amphibious landing to take and hold Karg Island, which is, of course, the oil export terminal for the Iranians. It would put very significant pressure on the regime if the Americans could do that. But, of course, it would come at huge potential cost in terms of the ability to hold that, because there's no doubt the Iranians would try to defend it, and they'd do that using drone attacks and missile attacks. And I mean, there was one expert speaking over the weekend that those troops could potentially be in a shooting gallery because of their exposure if they tried to hold that island.
There are also suggestions, aren't there, that there could be potentially even a riskier piece of action, which would be to actually try to seize the nuclear material that is in Iran, seize all of it and take it out of the country.
Yeah, so this is the, you know, 440 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium. There's another 200 kilograms of about 20% enriched, but all of that could easily be enriched up to weapons grade. Most of it is thought to be under the rubble in Natanz and Isfahan, the two nuclear facilities, two of the three that were bombed by the Americans last June. Now, the point about this is, and I spoke to Rafael Grossi, the head of the IAEA, the nuclear watchdog, a couple of weeks ago about this, and to try and take this material militarily is extremely dangerous for obvious reasons. But not just that, I mean, you know, it is thought to be in a sort of impenetrable condition under rubble, you know, in one case in a mountainside. So this would be a huge and potentially implausible military operation to get it. But again, anonymous briefings from the administration are that this is under consideration. Now, I think, again, that is intended to apply pressure. Whether it's actually possible, I think nobody actually really knows, but it would require something like an airstrip to fly it out from. So you're talking about a potentially weeks-long military operation to do that.
And when it comes to talks, what do we know about what's happening? Because Mr. Trump's talking, isn't he, about the Pakistanis' involvement, also suggesting that quite a few tankers, 20 now, are being allowed through the Strait of Hormuz under Pakistani flags. Is that verified by anyone?
Well, I mean, the Americans have certainly said that. That isn't independently verified. Although we know that the Iranians have been actually, you know, for weeks now allowing some cargo to pass, but usually if they believe it's going to, you know, their major purchasers like China and one or two others, and what they're extracting for that in return is not quite clear. But certainly Mr. Trump is claiming now that 20 tankers are being allowed to pass, and he's framing this as part of the negotiations, that this is effectively a confidence-building gesture, that they're in touch directly, he's now saying, with the Iranians. Again, the Iranians don't say that, and there isn't confirmation of that. I mean, what is clear is that there have been messages passed to the Iranians. We had this meeting yesterday involving the Saudis and then three of the mediating countries, so Turkey, Egypt and Pakistan, which then broke up on the Sunday. But there doesn't appear to be the potential for quick immediate talks between the Americans and the Iranians. Although Mr. Trump is giving that impression, it certainly seems a way off. And if you look at the American demands compared to what the Iranians have said, at least publicly in response, is that, you know, these two sides are so far apart, there doesn't seem to be a meeting point between them at this stage. And I think that's why you're getting, at the same time, the Americans briefing both the likely possibility of escalation quite quickly, but Mr. Trump also saying, well, this, you know, he's close, he believes he's close to settling it with negotiations. It may be that one is meant to bring pressure on the other.
Tom Bateman in Washington. Thank you.
It is coming up to 22 minutes to 7 o'clock. Sir Keir Starmer will hold talks today with Britain's largest energy suppliers as the government draws up contingency plans to deal with the possibility of shortages of diesel and of jet fuel. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, will be watching that closely. Who's going to be there, Henry? What's on the agenda?
Companies like BP and Shell. You've also got banks, HSBC and Goldman Sachs, and the insurer Lloyd's of London. And the plan is for them to discuss, Nick, the economic impact of the conflict here in the UK and to discuss what they need from the UK government. The business groups are also going to be briefed at this meeting by a senior naval officer, Major General Richard Cantrell, about the situation in the Strait of Hormuz. But we're not expecting any announcements to come out of this meeting. I mean, this is really about monitoring the situation, the government and various kinds of business in conjunction. In terms of influencing the situation, the UK continues to call for de-escalation, but that is obviously something that those present have no control over. Not just the businesses, but realistically, probably the Prime Minister and the UK government too. And by the way, there's a second meeting taking place today as well, which we should just briefly mention, which is the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, joining G7 finance ministers and also G7 energy ministers and central bank governors. And we're told she will urge them to follow the UK's lead in, she sees, enhancing energy security through commitment to more renewables and nuclear power.
One thing the government does have some control over is the price of petrol. It is interesting to see a growing number of countries, Australia overnight, in recent days, Ireland, Spain, Germany, all cut fuel duty. Is there any suggestion that the government wants to or indeed could afford to do that here?
Yeah, it's a really interesting announcement this overnight in Australia, partly because that Australian government is one from which this Labour government has sought to learn an awful lot at various points politically and in terms of how it governs, also because of the debate about the proposed rise in fuel duty later this year. I mean, I think from what Sir Keir Starmer has hinted on that proposed increase, it seems very likely that it is not going to happen, but I don't get any sense that that announcement is coming anytime soon. I mean, more generally, there is, I think, an expectation that some sort of government package will be coming later this year. We've talked about it particularly in the context of household energy bills, and certainly there is lots of contingency planning going on in various parts of government, even if, of course, they are hoping against hope that they won't have to activate those contingency plans. And a new call from the Conservative Party today for an immediate measure they say the government should take. They say the government should take VAT off household energy bills for the next 3 years.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It is 20 to 7. Is there or is there not going to be a new deal to persuade the French to stop people, most of them, of course, young men, crossing the Channel in small boats? The existing deal ends tomorrow. Simon Jones is our reporter, who's in Kent for us this morning. Simon, the existing deal comes to an end tomorrow. It seems odd, doesn't it, that there isn't a new one in place. Do we know what the sticking point is?
Well, negotiations are continuing is the official line, but you're right, it is going to the wire. What Britain and France are looking at is whether Britain's going to give France another 3 years of funding to try to stop the boats. And the last deal, a three-year deal, cost Britain £476 million. Now, the official line from the government is they're looking at long-term value for money and flexibility and innovation. I think we can interpret that as they're looking at performance-related clauses. So I've been on the beaches in northern France where you go to hotspots where you know that boats set off from those beaches frequently and there haven't been any police or there's just been a couple of officers who say there's not a lot we can do. So I think the government is saying, look, we are interested in a new deal. It's in the interest of both sides to get a new deal, but we do need something written into this programme about what exactly French officers are going to do and the bang you're going to get for your buck.
And of course, the underlying fact is, isn't it, that, what was it, 41,000 or so crossing the Channel last year, which was quite a big rise on 2024. In other words, you could say, and presumably the British government might say, well, look, for this money, we have not got much.
Well, if you look at the figures for this year, I've just been looking at them. So 4,440 people have made the crossing. That's actually down by around a third compared with the first 3 months of last year. But the French authorities say they've stopped about 2,000 people making the crossing. So that's around a third of people stopped from making the crossing. And in those figures, you've got to take into account as well that some of those stopped will be people who make this crossing repeatedly, those crossing attempts, because once someone is stopped, they're simply released back into the community. Most of them aren't detained, so they can try again and again. So there have been questions about the value for money. The British government saying, well, actually, 40,000 crossing attempts have been stopped since Labour came to power. They're making soothing noises, saying that it's mutually beneficial to stop the boats, and France is the most important migration partner when it comes to trying to stop those boats. But I think behind the scenes, the Entente Cordiale may not be so cordial at the moment.
Simon Jones, thank you.
It is now 17 minutes to 7. The weather looks good for NASA's launch schedule for Artemis 2. If it does go to plan this week, the launch, four astronauts will be heading to the moon. Their voyage will pave the way for a lunar landing and eventually a moon base. Now, more than 50 years ago, America's Apollo missions made history when the first people did set foot on the lunar surface. With six landings in total, it may have felt like the moon had been well and truly ticked off the space to-do list. So why is the US spending so much time, effort and money racing to return to the moon? Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, can explain.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
The words of US President John F. Kennedy setting America on course to the moon. In 1969, the Apollo program made history with the first lunar landing.
The Eagle has landed.
And astronauts continued to go to the moon until 1972. Now, after more than 50 years, NASA is heading back. But why is the US so intent on returning?
So that little black rock you can see there is a piece of the moon that was collected by Apollo astronauts and brought back to Earth in 1972.
Professor Sarah Russell is a planetary scientist at the Natural History Museum in London, where the precious piece of lunar material is on display. And it's what these rocks contain that's getting people excited. The moon holds the potential for a gold rush.
The moon has got the same elements in it that we have here on Earth. So an example is rare earth elements, which are very scarce on Earth. And there might be parts of the moon where these are concentrated enough to be able to mine them.
But the moon's most sought-after resource is a surprising one, water.
It has water trapped in some of its minerals. And it also has substantial amounts of water on the poles, the colder parts of the moon, especially regions which are called permanently shadowed craters. So these are areas that never ever see sunlight, and so they're super cold, and they can act as cold traps where ice can potentially build up.
Water is vital for creating a moon base, and it's at the heart of a 21st century space race.
All Russia's just wild about Yuri Gagarin, first man to conquer space. At Cape Canaveral, the Americans, though disappointed at not being first, are training these men to be astronauts and may still have a man on the moon before anyone else.
Last time round, America was in a battle with the Soviet Union for space dominance. Today, it's China who's the competition. China's made fast progress with its space program, and it plans to get humans to the moon by 2030. Both countries want the best lunar real estate, with the most abundant resources.
I think the real driver right now is that geopolitical incentive to be the first major power that gets to the South Pole.
Dr. Helen Sharman is the first British astronaut, and she says it really matters who wins the race to the moon.
So although you can't own a piece of the land because of the UN Outer Space Treaty, you can basically operate on that land without anybody interfering with it. So that's the big thing right now, is to try and, yes, to grab your piece of land. You can't own it, but you can use it. And once you're there, you've got it for as long as you want it.
But the US wants to go even further.
Returning to the moon is a stepping stone for going to Mars.
Libby Jackson is the head of space at the Science Museum. She says a mission to the Red Planet will have to overcome huge technological challenges, but the moon is the perfect testing ground.
There are many technologies that are essential for learning to live and work in space, particularly power, protection from radiation, recycling technologies. These are all technologies that, if you try them for the first time on Mars and they go wrong, are potentially catastrophic. It's much safer and much easier to try them out on the moon.
We will see things that no human has ever seen.
We want to know what's out there just beyond the horizon.
Amazing. Then there's the inspiration factor.
We were always going to the moon.
Pushing ourselves to explore is core to who we are.
The Artemis astronauts heading around the moon will be watched by the scientists and engineers of tomorrow. And who knows what their future will hold and the impact they'll have on the world and beyond.
When humanity sets big goals, we can accomplish extraordinary things.
Rebecca Morell reporting. 12 minutes to 7 is the time. There is a call for labels on food to be made more honest. It comes from a group of 42 Labour MPs who represent rural constituencies. Noah Law is on the line, who's the MP for St Austell and Newquay in Cornwall, and is leading the Labour Rural Research Group's campaign. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What is it that you want done?
So we're looking for honest labelling, and this really comes from our desire to improve farm profitability in the UK. It's one of the most emailed in, most salient issues in my inbox and in the inboxes of many MPs, is that consumers want us to do more to make clear the welfare standards and the origin of our food. And it's also a big boon to farmers if we can get it right. So DEFRA themselves have estimated that up to £60 million more profit could go into farmers' pockets if we're to have clearer labelling.
Right, so the clearer labelling would tell you what? So, for instance, on, I don't know, a pork pie or something that has a Union Jack on it at the moment, or whatever the label is, what would it tell you?
So the idea is that we go from a much less clear system now to a sort of graded system, a bit like the Australia-made system, but of course without a kangaroo on it. And we'd have basically clear labelling of both the production origin as well as the ingredients origin as well. And it's, yeah, sort of graded scale that we're looking for, much, much clearer than what we have now. Because as you say, with, say, a pork pie, a manufactured product, there's really not very many restrictions in terms of how you put, you know, how you use a Union Jack, for example. It's really not very clear for consumers where that product actually comes from.
But the big thing that would drive it then is that you believe, do you, that people would be willing to pay more for products that they could see definitely were entirely originated here?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, 6 out of 10 people want to see more British products on the supermarket shelves.
But they might not want to pay more for them.
Yes, well, in the grand scheme of things, we're not talking a huge amount here. Of course, the beauty of this campaign as well is that this would actually be voluntary. It's about getting the right information to consumers, and the fact is 93% of consumers said they'd be willing to pay more for a British product. So it's about giving consumers choice. That really is the beauty of the honest labelling campaign.
Is it also about repairing relationships with farmers who were aggrieved at the decision to put inheritance tax on family farms in your first budget, albeit that decision was then watered down, wasn't it? What is the state of the relationship, would you say, as the MP for St Austell and Newquay, with farmers?
Yeah, I mean, for me locally, it's been quite good because, of course, being a member of this actually quite powerful backbench group, we've managed to get refinements to the agricultural property relief policy, which were very, very welcome. It's a much more balanced approach now, which protects a small family farm. And the reason that we've sort of banded together now is we've got this, you know, this huge number of rural MPs, many of whom are from the 2024 intake, and lots of eagerness to get to work to show that, you know, by the end of this parliament, We've driven profitability for farms to a better place. It's important that we do that because without profitability, it's really difficult to incentivise farmers to invest in our food security.
The government to change plans when it came to inheritance tax. Are you on this as well? Are you getting any kind of intimation that what you want with labelling is going to happen?
So our hope here is that we're pushing on an open door because this recommendation that we're making is not entirely new. There was a review done in 2023-24, I think, from DEFRA that outlined what needs to be done to clarify origin labelling. So it's not an entirely origin and welfare labelling, I should say. So what we're asking is not entirely new here. And the Batters Review on Farm Profitability itself made various recommendations about how to do clearer labelling.
OK, so you think it may well happen. Noah Law, MP for Dorsal and Newquay. Thank you.
It is now 7:07, excuse me. Hyper-unrealistic body expectations created by social media have led to a surge in the number of people seeking help for mental health problems, for what in particular is called body dysmorphia. Dr. Adrian James joins us. He's NHS England's National Medical Director for Mental Health and Neurodiversity. Good morning to you, Dr. James.
Good morning, Nick.
Let's begin by defining our terms, if we can. What do we mean by body dysmorphia?
Well, Nick, it's perfectly natural to pay attention to your appearance. I mean, many of your listeners will be doing that at this moment as they get ready for their day. And I guess we're all on a spectrum as to how important that is to us, partly because of our personality, partly even the job that we do. But body dysmorphic disorder is taking it to a whole different serious level where people become extremely preoccupied by perceived flaws in their appearance. It may be a particular area of their body. It might be their whole appearance. So they might spend a lot of time comparing themselves to other people, looking at images on social media, looking in mirrors, and it may lead to some damaging behaviours, repeated scratching, or even seeking cosmetic procedures. And when people have cosmetic procedures, very often they might be satisfied for a little bit, but then the whole cycle repeats itself again. And this can affect people's lives in so many ways, their relationships, their ability to get out and socialise, training, education, work. So it can be really very damaging.
I refer to a surge in the number of people seeking help. Give us a sense of the scale, please.
There are approximately sort of 1 in 100 people in England experience body dysmorphic disorder. And we've had a surge in people coming forward for treatment, and treatment is available and the treatment works. So we have a world leading NHS talking therapies program. We assess nearly 2 million people a year, and the majority of people really do benefit from talking therapies. So I would ask people to come forward and make sure that we can treat people who are currently not getting treatment.
Because one answer might be to deal with what we're going to be discussing later in the programme, the algorithms that drive people to see images that are so damaging for them.
Yes, I mean, that has been a powerful influence, particularly in recent years. We know that there are multiple causes. It tends to run in families. It can be sparked by a traumatic event, particularly something like bullying around appearance. But we know that nowadays that people are surrounded by hyper-unrealistic body expectations. Many social media sites encourage people to upload images of themselves. They're compared, they're criticised. So you start a vicious cycle, and you can never get to that level that social media says in some cases that we should be aspiring to.
But while we're waiting for whatever it is the government will do about algorithms, about social media for the young, your message from the NHS in England is therapy can help.
Absolutely. The NHS is here for you. The therapy works. Don't suffer in silence. Talk to trusted friends and family, but come forward and have that treatment. It really does work.
And for parents struggling to deal with social media, is your advice try to just stop people, or at least limit young people's use of it?
Well, I think education is key here. Talk to your children, talk about their own experience. They may be hiding their experience from you. Try to encourage them to be open about it. talk about the dangers of social media. Of course, parents need to limit under some circumstances. Schools do this in a very active way. And so, but I think education is key and parental supervision, but we know that can only go so far.
Dr. Adrian James, NHS England's National Medical Director for Mental Health, thanks for joining us.
On BBC iPlayer.
What you see, you can't unsee.
Everything from nightmare fuel.
There's a beast on this island!
We've seen it!
We will have vengeance.
To nightmare remedies.
It's okay, I'm fine!
Don't laugh at me!
What's catch of the day? You are, Alan.
From chilling drama to laugh-out-loud comedy. Why ever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
Let's stream the weather now. Stavden House.
Thank you, Nick and Justin. Good morning to you. Well, this upcoming week looks very mixed once again. We're starting this week off on a settled note, actually. Well, after we move through today, high pressure builds in. That'll bring some very mild, pleasant weather Tuesday and Wednesday. But then as we move deeper into the week and approach the Easter weekend, low pressure looks like it'll take over, bringing unsettled weather with stronger winds, rain, even some wintry showers on the hills across Scotland. Today, much of Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern and Eastern England starting off windy with further blustery showers. Some of these have been heavy through the night with hail, and we've seen snow continue to fall on the hills in Scotland. Much of Wales and the Midlands, Southern England starting today mainly dry with some sunny spells. Still quite blustery though, but as we move into the afternoon those winds begin to ease down for all areas. It will turn a little bit quieter for many. However, northeast Scotland, the Northern Isles do stay blustery with further heavy showers here. The rest of Scotland, Northern Ireland, England and Wales are quieter afternoon with lighter west northwesterly winds and temperatures with some sunny spells ranging from 9 to 12 degrees. That's around average for the time of year. As we head through tonight, we start to see some warmer air moving around this area of high pressure, which will start to build in across the UK. So tonight will be rather cloudy, a few clear spells. The cloud may be thick enough for some drizzle across western hills, but it will be noticeably milder, temperatures 5 to 10 Celsius. So it means we start tomorrow on a milder note. With quite a lot of cloud around, with the high pressure though dominating, the winds will be lighter from the west or the southwest. Few showers likely for the northeast of Scotland, the Northern Isles again, where it'll be quite blustery, but for most it's dry, and given some sunny breaks to the west of higher to the east of higher ground, it'll feel very mild with temperatures ranging from around 11 to 15 Celsius, could hit 16 or 17 in the warmest spots.
Stav, thank you for that. You're listening to Today with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 30th of March. The headlines this morning. President Trump says negotiations with Iran are moving along very nicely. But he's also suggested seizing both the Hagar Island oil terminal and Tehran's stockpile of enriched uranium. A former US Middle East envoy tells us that might backfire.
Iran could escalate by striking at Gulf targets and thus increase the price and pain of not being able to export oil. That's the dangerous gamble here.
Energy bosses and other business leaders are meeting Keir Starmer in Downing Street to discuss the impact of the war on the cost of living. And the boss of Travelodge has told the BBC guests are safe in its hotels after a sexual assault where the attacker deceived staff to gain access to the victim's room. More on that story at 20 to 8.
And coming up in the next hour as well, will there be a new deal to persuade the French to stop people crossing the Channel in small boats? And indeed, does that deal really matter? Plus,
okay, now we're coming up on the view. We really want you to see us, the view of the Earth. And if you'll break for just a minute, Bill's going to put on the large lens. So we'll be right back with you.
We're back to the moon this week. Well, we hope we are. We'll be talking to the astronaut Tim Peake about Artemis 2. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said negotiations between the US and Iran about bringing the war to an end are going extremely well. He's told the Financial Times he doesn't think the Iranians would be able to defend Hagar Island, their main terminal for oil exports. The price of Brent crude remains high, trading at around $115 a barrel. From Washington, here's our correspondent Tom Bateman.
President Trump's claim that Iran was close to conceding to his demands came alongside a series of anonymous briefings from US officials about the apparent readiness of troops to carry out ground operations. Thousands of US Marines are now in the region with special forces and paratroopers on the way. The administration is making it known the president is considering anything from a raid on Iran's oil export terminal, Karg Island, to an audacious but likely implausible operation to seize its stockpile of highly enriched uranium, which Mr. Trump calls Iran's nuclear dust. Speaking on Air Force One last night, he said Iran was ready to hand it over, and if not, it wouldn't have a country anymore. Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf, suggested Mr. Trump was using talk of negotiations as cover for planning a ground attack, saying Iran would not accept surrender and its men were waiting for the American soldiers to set them on fire.
In Australia, the government has approved measures to help with the cost of living, including halving duties on petrol and diesel for 3 months. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said he understood people were under severe pressure. Here, Sir Keir Starmer is to host business leaders at Downing Street to discuss the impact of the Iran war on the UK's economy. Our business editor, Simon Jack, reports.
Among those attending the meeting will be representatives from Shell, BP, the Lloyd's insurance market, as well as the shipping giant Maersk and banks such as Goldman Sachs and HSBC. There'll be a military briefing on the security situation in the Strait of Hormuz. Downing Street is describing it as a roundtable discussion on how the government and the private sector can work together to reduce the impact of the war on the cost of living. The Prime Minister will reiterate that the best way to do that is through de-escalation, but that is something the attendees have no control over. Separately, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will urge other G7 finance ministers to reduce their collective reliance on imported fossil fuels. Her solution is to press ahead with more renewables and nuclear, a different message than the opposition leader Kemi Badenoch will take to Scotland. She will put the emphasis on more North Sea oil and gas drilling, which she accepts may have little impact on prices, but may give you more jobs and tax revenue to spend on any interventions needed to help households.
Israel has been carrying out more airstrikes on Iran, while the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered an extension of what he called the security zone in southern Lebanon. Our correspondent James Waterhouse is in Jerusalem.
Benjamin Netanyahu says the aim of this ground incursion is to definitively thwart the invasion threat from Hezbollah and push anti-tank missile fire away from the border. It's thought his troops will look to seize territory up to the Litani River, where thousands of people are being forced from their homes. The Israeli military says it's been carrying out new waves of attacks across Tehran as well. Earlier, there were reports of widespread power cuts in the Iranian capital and in the nearby city of Karaj. Despite the continued heavy airstrikes by Israel and the US, Iran is still able to hit back at either Israel or the Gulf states with drone and missile attacks of its own. The Iranians hit a power station and water plant in Kuwait, killing a worker, according to officials there. Saudi Arabia says it intercepted 5 ballistic missiles.
The boss of Travelodge has said the hotel chain is looking at how it can make further changes to protect customers after a woman was sexually assaulted by a man who was given a key card to her room by staff. The attack happened in Berkshire in 2022. Last month, Kieran Smith, who's 29 and from Surrey, was jailed for 7.5 years. In an interview with BBC Breakfast, the chief executive of Travelodge, Joe Boydell, insisted guests were safe in its hotels.
Clearly we've made mistakes, and I genuinely apologise to the victim for what happened to her and the way that we handled her case subsequently. It clearly wasn't good enough. That's why we've made some immediate changes, and that's why we are taking a good, long, hard look at this in terms of an independent review to really thoroughly but urgently investigate what we need to change.
In response, the victim, who can't be named to protect her anonymity, says she doesn't accept the apology.
They're only doing things as and when they need to, rather than actually thinking, actually, no, this is wrong. It's like they're taking slow steps to get to the right point, but they're not getting there fast enough. I feel like they should have realised the problem before this, and they shouldn't have made me feel so dismissed.
A gunman who'd been on the run in Australia since last August has been shot dead by police. Desi Freeman had been wanted for killing 2 police officers and seriously injuring a third in the state of Victoria. Police haven't said how they found him. Freeman, who was 56, described himself as a sovereign citizen, opposed to the government and the law. Here's our Australia reporter, Simon Atkinson.
7 months ago, Desi Freeman vanished into a rugged national park after shooting 3 officers who'd arrived at his home with an arrest warrant. What followed was one of the country's biggest manhunts, with a $1 million Australian reward for information. Earlier this year, Victoria Police revealed they strongly believed Freeman was dead, but they hadn't entirely ruled out that he was being harboured or was hiding in the rough terrain, which detectives conceded he knew far better than them. Freeman was tracked to a property 110 miles from where he was last seen. Police say he was killed after refusing to surrender during a three-hour standoff. Investigations are now focusing on how he'd managed to escape and who, if anyone, had been helping him.
The final details of the compensation scheme for drivers' missold car finance agreements are being published by the Financial Conduct Authority this afternoon. It's previously said 14 million deals, nearly half the total between 2007 and 2024, could have led to overcharging. The average payout is expected to be around £700 per agreement. Sir Billy Connolly has taken on a new role as a tour guide for the Kelvingrove Art Gallery and Museum in his home city of Glasgow. He's recorded an audio guide celebrating favourite exhibits, such as Alistair Gray's painting Cowcaddens, as well as his memories of the museum. In it, Sir Billy, who's 83, explains why Kelvingrove means so much to him.
I've always known Kelvingrove since I was a wee boy. I moved to Partick from Anderston when I was four. And this was a great thing to visit. And my father used to take us for walks on a Sunday. And then, when I was old enough, I'd be about six or seven, he would take me to the art gallery on a Sunday. That was wonderful. And it lasted me my whole life.
Jane Rowlands, who's the head of Glasgow Museums, says Sir Billy was the obvious person to voice the audio tour.
What we wanted to do was create something which the listener can really feel. They were talking to Billy, to hearing his thoughts and his memories of the building. He speaks about the place with such fondness that you can't help but be engaged by it. It's quite a wonderful listen, actually.
That was Jane Rowlands from Glasgow Museums.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven is the time. Donald Trump has told the Financial Times that he might seize Karg Island, the oil terminal through which Iran exports most of its oil. Maybe we take Karg Island, maybe we don't, he said. He's also said on Air Force One that the killing of senior Iranian leaders was bringing substantive talks closer.
I think we've had regime change. I mean, you can't do much better than that. The regime that was really bad, really evil, was the first one. That was done. The second was appointed. And they're gone. They're all dead, other than one who may have a little life in them. And then they're really in the third group. And the third group of people that seem to be much more reasonable. It truly is regime change.
Let's talk to Lisa Dissett, our chief international correspondent. Perhaps first, Lisa, about Karg Island, because it would be a major operation, wouldn't it?
Good morning. A major operation, a risky operation, an audacious operation. The United States, the numbers keep changing, of course, are said to have about 50,000 forces in that theater, including its most elite forces like the Navy SEALs. You remember they were the forces Barack Obama used to capture and kill Osama bin Laden in 2011. But it is possible. Karg Island is being described as about the size of Manhattan. It's just off the coast of Iran. Possibly they could make a go to make a landing on Karg Island. There were U.S. military strikes which attacked most of the military installations there earlier in this war. But they would be under fire as they go in from Iranian, then they would be in range of Iranian artillery, of Iranian fast boats. And then what? They're sitting ducks. How do you control the island? How do you hold it? How do you resupply it? There are hardline Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps who are hoping that is what President Trump is going to do. Their whole strategy in this war is to increase the cost for the United States. And nothing increases the costs more than killing American soldiers. And of course, U.S. allies in the Gulf will also be more vulnerable to Iran's retaliatory attack. This would be a major escalation and wouldn't bring end the war. And it does cut off one of Iran's main lifelines. Before the war, 90% of their oil went through this hub. We don't know how much of the oil now. It would be a major blow to Iran, but again, it wouldn't end the war.
And on the subject of ending the war, Donald Trump also saying, and we just heard him say it, haven't we, that there's this group of people who he says seem to be much more reasonable. It truly is regime change. What do you make of that?
It's just not clear who is in charge in Iran. There is, of course, President Trump's confusion about regime change and change in the regime. He used to separate them, but now he sees them as one and the same. It's not the one and the same. It is true that the assassinations have eliminated the highest echelons of the security and political establishment. But what has been left are the more hardline elements, not as President Trump would say, the most reasonable elements. Just a quick look at that. There's been no sight or sound of the supreme leader since he was selected, Mujtaba Khamenei, the son of the last leader who was assassinated in the first hours of the war. He's said to be alive but injured, but functioning. But it's always asked, does he write his statements or does someone do it for him? The other name that is mentioned is Mohammed Bagher Ghalibaf. He's the Speaker of the Parliament, has played key roles in the security establishment. He's become the troller-in-chief, dueling with President Trump, the US's troller-in-chief, on social media, so much so that now his posts on social media are becoming so clever that people are asking, well, who's writing Mohammed Ghalibaf's post? Who are Pakistan is said to be the country which is having the most contact with those who are supposed to be in charge. But when we speak to diplomats in the region, they say even Pakistan is confused about who's in charge. Yes, they have points of contact. Pakistan's Field Marshal Asim Munir is said to have had talks with Mohammed Bagher Ghalibaf, but Pakistan's Prime Minister said he had an hour-long conversation with the President of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian, who's a relative reformer in Iran's system and has absolutely no authority. He would have to then pass on the messages to the people who are really in charge. We can't say individual names because now there are multiple actors. Mm-hmm. If you think that's easier, the last thing I will say, Justin, because it's not being mentioned a lot, for all the suspicion about Iran's highly enriched uranium, its movement toward developing a nuclear bomb, it was always said the line preventing that from happening was the fatwa of the last supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So now that he's gone, what will be the new security doctrine of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Lisa Sett, thank you. Let us turn to what's actually been happening overnight. The Israelis saying a couple of hours ago that they were striking Iranian military infrastructure across Tehran, and that in response to launches of missiles from there. The Kuwaitis saying in the last few minutes that they had intercepted drones in their airspace. Let us get an update of what happened over the wider weekend from our correspondent Joe Inwood.
Working by torchlight, a search and rescue team navigates a vast crater in the centre of a Tehran street. The beam of light pauses on the twisted remains of a motorbike before moving on. This has become a common scene as the US and Israeli strikes enter their fifth week. One man who lives nearby witnessed the aftermath.
Last night they hit the middle of the street near our house with no specific target. No building, no person, nothing. Just the middle of the street. The asphalt was torn up and a huge crater was created. Several parked and passing cars were turned to dust.
By daylight, it is a very different scene in Tehran, certainly the official version is. The historic bazaars and markets seem subdued but not empty in footage released by the news agencies. Colourful sweets are piled high. A man squeezes fresh pomegranate juice. Only one man speaks on camera, a computer programmer called Matin. He appears to be in his 20s and has a bag slung over one shoulder. We are fighting to prevent sanctions, to show the strength of the country, of our country, he says. For me, these things are more important than internet outages or anything else. But that message of defiance is not what you always get in private communications, as shared with BBC Persian News and voiced by their team.
My businesses are completely shut down now. My situation is not better than theirs. It's been very quiet, and I think I can hold up the business for 1 month maximum.
We're slowly starting to learn how to live with war. We're going out with the kids, open our shops, and we get emotional watching old photos and movies of Iran.
Just as getting information out of Iran is difficult because of the near total internet shutdown, so too is it hard for Iranians to hear from the outside world. But clearly, information does get in. Over the weekend, President Trump said this.
But they have to open it up. They have to open up the Strait of Trump. Hormuz. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. Such a terrible mistake.
Now, whether or not it was a joke, it seemingly upset Iranians, even those who oppose the regime.
Trump called the Strait of Hormuz the Trump Strait. The Strait of Hormuz and the Iranian islands are in danger of being lost.
Last night in Tehran, there was an unusual sound, certainly for those who watched this war from afar. Iranian air defences firing into the black sky. They appear to be aging AA guns, unlikely to shoot down a modern fighter jet. But they are still firing. In what is fast becoming a battle of wills, that is significant.
Joe Inwood reporting. You coming up just after 7:30, an interesting interview with David Satterfield, former US Middle East envoy, who says, in his words, something drastic will have to happen to persuade the Iranians that it is now worth doing a deal with Donald Trump. Quite what that will be, we will explore with him in a few minutes' time. At 18 minutes past seven, let's turn instead now to the events on a busy Saturday night in Derby city centre, a night that felt like any other for most of the people out at the beginning of an evening of fun and partying, until that is, a black Suzuki Swift was driven into pedestrians in Friargate, hitting and injuring seven people in the city centre. People are continuing to question a man arrested on suspicion of attempted murder, but are not at this stage treating it as a terror attack. Let's talk to the mayor of the East Midlands about what she knows about this. Claire Ward, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
See if you can make sense for people listening to this. On the one hand, the police, and I, as I've just said, are not treating this as terrorism, but there are anti-terror police involved in the investigation. How do you make sense of that?
Well, we understand that that is a fairly standard practice. And obviously, at this stage, it's very important that we let the police continue with their investigations and their inquiries and make the appropriate decisions. Obviously, I would encourage people who may have dash cam or mobile phone footage from that time to be there. This is a serious but isolated incident. And I know that for those not just involved who were injured on the evening, but anybody who was around the city centre and had first-hand experience of what happened, this will be a really frightening time for them. And so the city itself and all our agencies across the city will want to do all it can to support people at this difficult time.
You're trying, no doubt, to reassure people by stressing that it's isolated. The shock, as you've suggested there, of what happened, what people heard, what they saw, is likely, though, to last an awfully long time, isn't it?
That's right. And we know that the repercussions of violent acts like this don't end just in that moment. There will be real upset and trauma for many people who witnessed what happened on the night, as well as, of course, those victims who were directly impacted, and obviously very concerned about them. But we understand that there were obviously no fatalities. Two people have already been discharged and from the hospital, and more, we hope, soon, and returning to be able to recover.
In other cities, Claire Ward, we
make sure that anybody who was around there and have any additional information for the police, that they make that available to the police as soon as possible.
In other cities where cars have been used as a weapon, there have been design changes to those cities to make it harder to do. Anybody crossing Westminster Bridge, for example, here in London, will know there are now barriers to stop cars coming off the roadway and actually hitting those people who were walking on that bridge. Are there things that might be looked at in Derby, do you think?
Well, you're absolutely right. And measures such as bollards and other things have taken place right across some of our towns and cities in the East Midlands. And I'm sure that all of the authorities, including the City Council, will take time to look again and see if there's anything that can be done. But this is an area of a road which is popular with clearly people moving through it in and out of the city. And so we need to make sure that we're able to take precautions wherever possible, but ensure that people are still able to move around and enjoy this fantastic city of Derby and all that it has to offer.
Claire Ward, thank you for joining us.
22 minutes past seven is the time. There is a worldwide ban at the moment on imposing tariffs on digital goods, so downloads, software, streaming, etc. America wants that ban on those tariffs extended, but it has, it seems, effectively expired. Leanna is back with that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Leanna.
Yeah, that's right. Ministerial talks at the World Trade Organization stretched into overtime on Sunday, with countries still divided over that key rule that bans tariffs on digital trade, which is due to expire tomorrow. But 66 nations, including the UK, have gone ahead with a separate digital trade deal covering things like data rules and custom processes. But the question is the WTO losing its grip on global trade? Chris Southworth is Secretary General at the International Chamber of Commerce, United Kingdom, and is on his way back from the conference in Cameroon. Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, what happens? No problem. What happens if this deal on digital tariffs lapses? And is it really difficult to get a deal over the line between countries these days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had 2,000 trade officials, 90 ministers, hundreds of people from civil society and business, all in Cameroon, Yaoundé, for 4 days. And it's just really disappointing to come away with frankly nothing of any substance. There was the bones of a deal on the table on Saturday afternoon that we could have all probably lived with. And then that was torpedoed that night by the US. The two big actors over the last 4 or 5 days have been India and the US, who both come in with very sort of dogmatic approaches. For the US, they were going all or nothing on this ban on customs duties on digital content. And then India torpedoed a huge plurilateral deal on investment of 130 countries led by China. So the 66 countries that have moved forward on e-commerce, you know, that effectively is 66 countries representing 70% of global trade saying enough's enough. We're just going to get on now and implement. That's great news for business. But the big question in the WTO now is around trade deals.
Yes.
There's no multilateral trade deals on the table or anywhere close on the horizon. And what's been demonstrated here is there's no likelihood of any plurilateral trade deals. So that's coalitions of the willing. That was the approach. Those have effectively been torpedoed until we have reform. And that's the crucial point here.
Chris,
we're coming away with nothing.
I think this is sorry to cut across you. I think this is an important question. Is the WTO, is it irrelevant now?
No, not at all. No, it's crucial. It's the operating system of world trade, but it needs an upgrade. You know, so think of it as an operating system. If you're on your computer, you're getting flashing signals saying click upgrade, reboot, refresh. And that's been going on for well over a decade in the WTO, and no one has clicked the button. And it's absolutely evident in today's geopolitical context, it's really difficult to get everyone to agree. So, and we just have to accept the world's in a tough place.
Yeah.
But we need a flexible decision-making structure to allow countries that want to move forward to move forward. And wherever we can get consensus, let's go for wider consensus. But to do all of that...
Chris Southworth, Secretary General at the International Chamber of Commerce, United Kingdom, thank you so much for joining us.
If you're like me, you've been wondering what the difference between plurilateral and multilateral is. Multilateral means all members of an organisation. Plurilateral, apparently a subset. We are here to serve. It is 26 minutes past seven. The weather is looking good for the launch of Artemis 2 this week. If all goes well, four astronauts will soon be heading to the moon, paving the way for the first lunar landing since 1972, and eventually the creation of a NASA base on the moon's surface. Why the excitement, though, given that it's more than 50 years since man first put foot on the moon? The ideal people to explain that are the hosts of a BBC podcast following the mission called 13 Minutes Presents Artemis 2, and they are Dame Maggie Adarin, British space scientist, co-presenter of The Sky at Night, and Major Tim Peake, retired British European Space Agency astronaut. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ned.
Dame Maggie, why the excitement about this mission?
Yes. So this mission, I like to compare it to a bit of a trilogy. Sometimes the middle mission seems a little unexciting, but it's doing a lot. So it's the first crewed mission for some new tech. And this new tech is going to get people to land on the moon eventually, but they're testing it with people on board. So they have four people on board. And this mission, it's sort of will orbit the Earth twice, and then it will get propelled out towards the moon. It will travel 4,600 miles beyond the far side of the moon, which is the furthest anyone has ever been into space. And then it will return, due to the Earth's gravity, back to Earth. So it's covering, it's testing the technology, the first crewed mission, and it's going further than anyone has gone before.
Well, that's one reason it's exciting. But Major Tim, there may be older listeners thinking, well, hold on, we did this half a century ago. Why do we need a mission to see if we can land on the moon?
Absolutely. Well, the difference between this mission and the Apollo missions is this is part of a program that's looking at putting humans back on the moon for a sustained period of time to actually build a base, a research laboratory at the south pole of the moon, to have a gateway in orbit around the moon as a stepping stone to Mars eventually. But this is why it's different, because we're actually going to be staying on the moon. We're going to be using that as a research facility.
And we were hearing Dame Maggie earlier in the programme, this is part of a new 21st century space race, that it matters not to own the land, because you can't do that at the moment, but to at least occupy some of it.
Yes. And so, as Tim says, this is sort of a grander design. We're not just sort of going to the moon, you know, playing golf, you know, driving buggies and coming back. We are actually trying to use it as a stepping stone to the rest of the solar system. And I think there is a sort of, between China and the US, there's sort of quite a bit of I won't say saber rattling, but they're trying to get their stake on the moon. I think if we look at the future, the moon is going to play a vital role in sort of all of our space travel. So getting established on the moon now makes a lot of sense.
It was sometimes said in the past about astronauts that they went because it was there, a bit like mountaineers want to go up mountains, Major Tim. But in this case, we now want what's on the moon, or at least the countries competing to get there are keen to get hold of those minerals and that water.
Yeah, I think we explore space for three reasons. We go for science, we go for exploration and inspiration. And Maggie's touched on the science. You know, there's so much that we don't know about the surface of the moon, things that we can learn to help explain the formation of the Earth, the early solar system, and some of the resources that are on the moon that could be useful to us. We're going to learn a lot about the medical body, the human body, and the medical aspects of long duration space travel. And then there's the exploration part, you know, that innate desire for humans to know what's beyond that boundary. And then there's the inspiration factor. We saw from the Apollo, we had the Apollo effect, and we expect to have the same effect with this new program.
Just before I ask Maggie to tell us what we get if we listen to this podcast, Tim, you know what it is like the last few days before a launch when you can't be sure when it'll go because the weather affects it. You are obviously nervous. What is it like for an astronaut?
Yeah, there's a mixture of excitement, apprehension. They've done this before, but this time it looks like we really are set for a Wednesday evening launch. They'll be saying goodbye to their families. They'll be in quarantine. But I think mostly they'll just be going through those checks, those drills, focusing on the mission ahead, and it'll be mostly excitement.
And Maggie, we are talking to you. I get the joy of seeing you, whereas listeners just hear your voice in a very swanky new podcast studio. You appear to be a picture of the moon behind you and soundproofing all around you. Tell us what we can expect from the podcast.
13 Minutes Presents is the BBC's a podcast which covers sort of space. We've looked at the Apollo missions, we've looked at the space shuttle, but this time it's slightly different because we're doing it live, effectively. We will be following the Artemis mission every day. So it's a 10-day mission. We're starting 2 days before, and we'll be following the people who make the mission, sort of the people, yeah, we'll be getting the information as it comes in and transmitting it to everybody and translating it into something that's understandable.
And sharing,
so we're very excited about it.
Sharing some of the excitement. I was going to say, excitement's the word that comes to mind as you describe that. Dame Maggie Adderin and Major Tim Peake, co-hosts of 13 Minutes Presents Artemis 2. Get it on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you very much.
29 minutes to 8. Here is Cathy again with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. The BBC understands that Spurs want to convince Roberto De Zerbi to become their new permanent head coach after parting ways with Igor Tudor. After just 44 days in charge as interim head coach, Spurs are in 17th place in the Premier League, just 1 point above the relegation zone. Excuse me. Now, the Mercedes driver, Kimi Antonelli, took his second race win in succession at the Japanese Grand Prix to become the youngest driver at 19 years of age to lead Formula One's World Championship. It's the four-time world champion, though, Max Verstappen, who is making headlines after suggesting that he is considering his future in the sport. We can speak to the BBC's Formula One commentator, Harry Benjamin. Harry, there have been changes to the engine rules in Formula One this season. Why, though, are those changes having such a big effect on Verstappen?
Well, I think the bottom line is, as we've heard, he's not enjoying it. These new engine regs mean we've got this 50% internal combustion, 50% battery makeup of the engine. And that means what we're seeing on track in qualifying and races is that drivers end up having to slow down halfway through a straight or coast into the corners in order to harvest enough energy to essentially make it round a lap, which is not what Max Verstappen and many of the drivers believe it is right for the sport. It's not in the DNA.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. Formula One bosses are due to meet in the next few weeks, though, to discuss the changes to the rules. Will they take Verstappen's comments into account? And do you think he could really leave Formula One?
I mean, I absolutely think he could leave Formula One. If he's saying it, I believe it to be true. The teams will be meeting. The teams aren't quite aligned with the drivers on this front. Everybody is of the belief that we need to do tweaks to the rules, particularly in qualifying over one lap. But these rules were introduced to encourage new engine manufacturers into the sport. That's why we now have the Audi Formula One team. That's why Honda stayed. It's why Ford partnered up with Red Bull. It's why Cadillac are coming in and will eventually bring General Motors in as an engine manufacturer. So there's not quite an alignment there. But I cast people back to 2006, a driver called Juan Pablo Montoya, who left halfway through the year due to a poor car with McLaren. He was frustrated with the way Formula One was going and he wanted a new challenge and he left. Max Verstappen could well do the same thing.
That would be massive, wouldn't it? Races in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia have been cancelled due to the war in the Middle East. The next race is now in Miami in May, I think. In practical terms, how will this sudden 4-5 week break in the season really affect the teams?
Yeah, so it is about 5 weeks until Miami next. I think actually it will come as a benefit to the majority of the teams. It's been a really intense start to the season. We had Australia and China back to back and then just come off Japan, obviously. So I think there's a lot of work to be done for the teams back at the factory, not only to allow some of the mechanics and the engineers on the ground a rest, but I think it will be a lot of hard work going on at the factory in terms of the simulator. And for those teams that are struggling towards the back and haven't hit the ground running in this new era of Formula One, a crucial chance to begin that development race, which is so often what we talk about is the race about Formula One off the track as well as on it. So it's going to be a busy time in the factories.
Okay, Harry Benjamin, thank you very much for joining us this morning. A couple of other headlines for you. Golf and England's Alex Fitzpatrick, the younger brother of Matt, has won his first DP World Tour title at the Indian Open a week after his brother won the Valspar Championship. And in tennis, Jannik Sinner and Aryna Sabalenka have won the Miami Open singles titles to add to the Indian Wells titles they both won earlier this month. It's only the fourth time in history the same two players have won what's known in tennis as the Sunshine Double. Hoping my voice will hold out for another hour for you.
Can have a lovely cup of tea, Cathy. Thank you very much indeed. Let's hear about a new series from Polly Weston.
On BBC Radio 4.
The wall actually went across the pavements and through the gardens and across the road.
Communities divided for years by 8-foot-high walls, but not where you might think. This is a leafy Oxford suburb.
History has been revived with graffiti daubed on North Oxford Road, where the so-called Cutslow Wall was built in 1930.
I'm Polly Weston, and I'm asking what happened here after the walls came down.
There's a lot of snobbery, so it's them and us sort of thing. I think it still goes on.
The Shadow of the Cutslow Walls, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Monday to Friday at 1:45.
To the weather, it's going to be mostly dry, actually. Sunny spells in the morning. In the further north, there'll be scattered showers.
Coming up, what can the government get from the French government in order to limit those crossings across the Channel? You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson at 24 minutes to 8. Alan Smith has got a summary of the news.
President Trump has said he wants to take the oil in Iran and could seize Karg Island, through which most Iranian oil is exported. Mr. Trump has also said that a deal could be reached with Iran very soon and that talks were progressing well. Israel says it's carried out fresh attacks on Tehran and that its armed forces have been ordered to move further into southern Lebanon. The Israeli military have been targeting the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. Several Gulf states said they came under fire overnight. Downing Street says a meeting of the Prime Minister and leaders from the energy, shipping and finance sectors will aim to discuss how the government and the private sector can work together to respond to the war. The price of a barrel of Brent crude is currently around $115 a barrel. Travelodge's boss has said that the company would look at how they could do more to safeguard their guests after a man deceived staff to get a woman's key card and then sexually assaulted her. Joe Boydell apologised to the victim but insisted that Travelodge hotels were safe. She said a full independent review was now taking place and that changes to their policy had already been made. Police in Australia have shot dead a man wanted for killing two of their colleagues last August, ending a seven-month-long manhunt. Desi Freeman was tracked to a remote property in Victoria, where he was involved in a three-hour standoff before being shot. And the Financial Services Regulator will publish its final decision today on a scheme to compensate millions of drivers who were missold finance agreements. The Financial Conduct Authority has previously suggested nearly half of car finance agreements made between 2007 and 2024 were unfair and in line for compensation. The cost of the payout could total more than £8 billion.
Thank you, Alan. It's 22 minutes to 8 now. Once again this morning, the world is left to wonder. What exactly did he mean by that? Donald Trump told the FT overnight that he wants to take the oil in Iran, possibly to seize the Iranian export hub of Harg Island. And he said people who question that idea are stupid. At the same time, he insisted that talks with what he insists is a new regime in Tehran are going well. The man he constantly refers to, the Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Halibaf, says his country's forces are waiting for American ground troops so they can rain fire upon them. I've been trying to decode and interpret this war of words with the former US Middle East envoy under President Biden, David Satterfield. I began by asking what he made of that threat to take the oil in Iran.
If by that the president means that it would be possible as a military operation for the US to either blockade or to seize Karg Island, that exports about 90% of Iran's total exports, that's certainly feasible. The question is not so much what the U.S. could do, but what Iran's response would be. And the calculation must be, if in fact this is being contemplated, that Iran would, in the face of this, make concessions on the nuclear program, turn over the enriched uranium, and agree to some sort of constraints on its missile program at a minimum. But there's a very different analysis, which is that Iran possesses escalation dominance. That is to say, Iran could escalate by striking at Gulf targets, which are highly vulnerable to drones and missiles, and thus increase the price and bear, in the case of Iran, the pain of not being able to export oil. That's the dangerous gamble here.
Donald Trump may be listening to this sort of analysis and not much liking it, because when he spoke to the Financial Times, he said, quotes, people back in the United States would say, why are you doing that? Quotes, they're stupid people.
No, they are people who understand Iran, who understand Iran's continued ability to be able to strike. There have been notable hits on infrastructure in the Gulf over the last 24 hours, despite all of the damage, and it's significant, that Israel and the United States have inflicted. They're not stupid people.
It's also possible that Donald Trump is not stupid, isn't it? And that he realizes that in a negotiation, you have to look as if you've got a plan for if those talks fail, and a plan that might frighten your enemy.
Quite true. But the question here, and it's not one that I or I think any of us can answer right now, is there a serious negotiation going on? Is this buying time for a military operation, which, whatever it may be, aimed at the enriched uranium, aimed at oil products, aimed at something else that would be a dramatic potential shift in the situation, would then enable the president to declare a sweeping victory and find an off-ramp? And that's a very good question, but it's not one with a definite answer.
One hint, perhaps, in Donald Trump's latest statements is his continuing praise for the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Ghalibaf. He claimed, the president, that Iran had already had regime change.
Correct. There has been a regime change. Ayatollah Khamenei is no longer with us. Significant military figures are no longer with us. But the change has not been in what anyone could define as a positive direction. The current Speaker of the Parliament, the effective authority, it appears, in Iran, is a very, very hardliner. And I think the best comparator here is that you may have stripped away what remained of the 1978-79 revolution and its clerical leadership, and exposed what the regime had really become over the last years, a collection of hard men in the Northern Ireland term. And hard men don't bargain easily.
And do you think those hard men will ever agree to open the Straits of Hormuz? Or is there an argument that some apparently are making in the Gulf states, we wish we hadn't started this war, but now we have, we better finish it?
Well, that's certainly the Gulf argument. The worst possible outcome would be a pivot and exit by the United States and with it Israel that leaves Iran demonstrated to have the ability to close the Gulf at will and to strike infrastructure in the Gulf countries essentially at will. That would be a terrible outcome, because what would it do? It would show that what had been an Iranian threat or swagger to be able to do this was in fact proved to be a reality in the face of all that the U.S. and Israel could do. A very bad outcome indeed.
Is the price that either side are paying for this war high enough to force a deal? The United States is making more money from gas and oil as much of the world struggles to obtain it. And according to The Economist, at least, the Iranians are getting nearly twice as much money from oil sales as they were before the war, because they can supply it when so many others can't.
I don't see on the Iranian side, given the ideological bent of this collection of current leaders, security figures, are likely to concede much of anything. Would they accept a broad agreement in which they reiterate points that they have already made? They're not going to develop a nuclear weapon. They would, in fact, turn over to the IAEA the enriched uranium for some kind of further processing, perhaps ultimate return, things like that. That I think they could certainly do. It's not too far away from where the Iranian position has been for some time now. But to agree to open the strait without an absolute assurance that this campaign was over, the Iranians have to worry that were they to do so, the campaign might be over for now, but it would resume again at some point in the not-distant future. I think this is going to be a real hard one to bring to a close.
So finally, you sound to me like a man who thinks that any solution to this is some way off.
I do not see an immediate resolution, and to translate that into something a bit more graphic, I think something dramatic is going to have to happen. Whether that dramatic thing produces a different Iranian position or not, there I've outlined the doubts, the reservations, but I think that's what we're going to have to see.
Dramatic means a major military setback, does it?
It means something very flashy, very dramatic, a seizure, if it could be done, of the enriched uranium, a very difficult operation indeed, or the blockade or seizure of either Karg Island or other islands in the Gulf or territory adjacent to the strait, something of that order.
David Satterfield, Special Envoy for Middle East Humanitarian Issues under President Biden, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The time now, 7:45. In December 2022, a man was given a key to a woman's room at a Travelodge hotel in Berkshire. He had told the staff he was her boyfriend. He assaulted her and was later jailed. But the way the company handled the behaviour of that man, and indeed their relationship with the woman, the victim, horrified her. She said Travelodge had not taken it seriously at first. They offered her a £30 refund before eventually apologising. She still thinks they haven't done enough. The boss of Travelodge, Joe Boydell, has apologised again and spoken directly to some MPs, though not to the wider number who wanted to talk to her. And this morning she told BBC Breakfast that the organisation had made changes already and were looking at others.
With 22 million customers a year, that's hugely important to us, people being safe, but any incident where somebody gets access to a room is one too many, and so we're really looking through how we can actually improve and make sure that that doesn't happen.
Jen Craft is the MP for Thurrock, campaigner who has improved safety standards in hotels, and is also one of the MPs that Travelodge has spoken to. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Have they done enough?
I think they've still got a long way to go until people feel can feel safe in their hotels again. I've been listening to the interview with the victim, and I think the point that she makes about how the thing she raised with the CEO about a deadlock on the inside of her door not working, and the response of the CEO to those kind of points, I think is still really worrying. There's quite a way, I think, until you can feel that as a woman or a sole traveller in a travel lodge that actually you're safe staying there.
Which is an extraordinary state of affairs.
It really is. It really is. And I think the thing that is slightly worrying, beyond worrying about this situation, is that the kind of people that use travel lodges, and it's not just sole travellers, it's people that might use it because their company says that that's where they need to stay while they're travelling. I know that local authorities sometimes use them for temporary or emergency accommodation.
Would you go so far as to say that they should stop?
I think that they should certainly be asking these kind of questions. If you have a duty of care to someone as to where they're staying for a night, I think you should be asking yourself, are they safe staying at this accommodation you've placed them in? And in this case, if it's Travel Lodge, you should be making sure that that accommodation is safe.
And is it just Travel Lodge? I mean, are there other hotels you think also need to be looked at and indeed looking at their own procedures?
That's questions that we are asking further, sort of as MPs. We are saying, is this the standard across the industry? Is this something that is the case across, whether it's budget hotels or all hotels? From asking initial informal inquiries, it seems that people do have in some hotel chains fairly robust procedures in place, but we are asking whether or not there needs to be further action from a kind of regulatory or statutory level to make sure that people can feel safe when they stay in hotels.
Right, Jan Craft, MP for Thurrock, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is 11 minutes to 8. In a few minutes' time, we'll ask if the government can save a deal with France to slow the pace of small boats coming across the Channel, and what happens if they can't make a new deal. First, though, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Reverend David Wilkinson, Professor of Theology and Religion at St John's College, Durham University.
Good morning. A world of unpredictable leaders wanted to present themselves as strong men in control of their region. The use of the military in torturing and killing innocent people, fear and expectation of revolution, the manipulation of public opinion, and national identity shaped by religious ideology. Yes, I'm referencing today's news stories, but all these underlie the events central to what Christians call Holy Week. From the excitement and unrest of Palm Sunday, through to the cruelty of the death of Jesus on a cross, this Holy Week that Christians engage with and pray through is not a narrative of quiet and peaceful mindfulness. It's loud, violent, and disturbing. This special week of worship was named Holy Week, probably in the 4th century. The word holy has a sense of being set apart or separated. The danger is that this can easily lead to an understanding that a holy God is completely unaffected by the world, and that Christians should concentrate on spiritual things rather than getting their hands dirty in the grubbiness of the world. The events of Holy Week say something very different. In them, I see a God who experiences the vulnerability of human flesh in the midst of a complex political landscape,
and through giving himself up in humiliating death, offers a pattern and resources for forgiveness and hope. This is the holiness of God, who's present in the pain, sin, and uncertainty of this world. That's why some Christian traditions call this week the Great Week. In the background to last week's joyous celebration of the new Archbishop, there was an exhibition hosted by Canterbury Cathedral of prints, poetry and music called Jagged Edges, Stations of the Cross. It arose from a project here in the Newcastle Diocese, which engages victims and survivors of church-related abuse. It uses the narratives of betrayal, condemnation and violence of Holy Week as a means to speak both to fellow survivors and to those who have let them down. As Maggie Creese, who works with chaplaincy to survivors, comments, "Seeing in the story of Jesus God's love for and solidarity with those who've been abused, they invite people to engage in the work of repair, reconciliation and recovery. Real holiness means being set apart in the sense of sharing God's purpose and character of love and justice. For Christians, it's a call to live differently in the midst of the complex, jagged edges of the world, following Jesus, believing that change can happen, not through the exercise of power and violence, but through the way of the cross."
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend David Wilkinson. It's now 8 minutes to eight.
The agreement with France to get their cooperation in stopping people crossing the Channel in small boats comes to an end tomorrow. There are talks about a new agreement. So far, though, no deal. Basically, the old deal signed in 2023 was that we paid the French nearly £500 million and they used it to fund surveillance and beach patrols as well. The agreement sets out a clear commitment, the government said at the time, to increase the interception rate and drastically reduce the number of crossings year on year. Well, the facts are that 41,000 people came last year, which was a rise, a 13% rise on the year before, although the numbers early in the early months of this year are down. Let us talk to Rob Laurie, former soldier turned aid worker and indeed BBC podcaster. Rob, the initial effort was to reduce the numbers by the French being more active. Has it worked at all?
I remember talking on this very subject when this first deal was struck with yourselves, and we were quite optimistic. It hasn't worked, no, and nothing will work, unfortunately. I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but nothing will work until Europe has the same desire to stop boats coming across the Channel as the UK. Now, I remember back in 2015, I think it was, right in the centre of the camp in Calais, the big one where there were like 10,000 people, a reception centre was built right in the middle of there for people to register and to be able to live in that centre, give their fingerprints and everything. I think the uptake was something like less than 5%. They didn't even fill that reception centre.
The other thing the government is trying to do is smash the gangs, as they put it. And you have reported a lot on the smashing of the gangs. And in a sense, they have. I mean, some people have gone to jail, haven't they? That some of the gangs have been smashed. But that as well doesn't seem to work when it comes to the numbers.
I think the biggest problem about this is the government's inability to market their own success to the public, because I know, because I follow this very carefully, there have been some major arrests around Europe and in the UK, and some really long jail sentences handed out. For instance, a UK NCA-led operation put 21 people down for an average of 11 years. I didn't hear anything about that in the media. But in terms of smashing the gangs, if you want to put it that way, which I kind of don't like that term anyway, this issue, you know, the smuggling networks, I've always said, they come from the Middle East through Europe and into the UK. And it's more than just smashing the gangs.
Yeah.
You need real, real cooperation between everyone.
Rob, thank you for that. Let's talk to Madeleine Sumption, interim chair of the government's Migration Advisory Committee and director of the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Because the other side of this, of course, cut apart from the French being involved and the smashing of the gangs, etc., is whether there are pull factors that bring people to this country more than to any other. Is it fair to say that there are?
I think there are several reasons that people claiming asylum
want to come to the UK. Sometimes it's the English language. Sometimes they have friends and family here. I think one thing maybe that's underappreciated is actually some of the people coming over didn't choose the UK. They chose another EU country and then they were refused asylum here and are liable to be sent back. But if they are able to make it to the UK, then they would have another chance at an initial decision. So it's a very complicated picture. There are push factors, there are pull factors, but there isn't a single thing that is encouraging people to come.
And of course, one of the big questions, I mean, you can't answer this, none of us can, but Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, obviously wants to change the rules so that if you do get the right to stay here, it isn't a permanent right. And you wonder whether that might also have an effect on people's decision making or whether actually it's so far in advance that it won't.
It might have some impact. The challenge here, we have evidence from other countries like Denmark and Sweden, for example, which did actually see a reduction in the number of people claiming asylum after introducing similar measures. At the same time, we wouldn't necessarily expect the impact to be really big because the impacts of those measures that sort of restrict people's rights after they arrive, it's not nothing, but it doesn't tend to be a sort of major factor.
And also, of course, look at what's going on in Iran at the moment. The expectation, presumably, among experts is that the numbers, at least who are trying, are going to increase.
Iran has been a major country of origin for people claiming asylum in the UK. Obviously, the situation in Iran is very unpredictable, and so it's very difficult to say at this stage how many people will leave Iran. Most people who do leave are likely not to make it as far as the UK. Most people tend to stay more local. But certainly, if there is a big increase in the number of people leaving, then we would expect to see some impact of that in the UK because the UK has been a major destination for Iranians.
And a quick thought about the French. Do you know what's holding up the deal?
I'm not involved in those negotiations. There are reportedly, and not much has been said publicly, there are reportedly sticking points around whether France can do more. Obviously, the enforcement that has taken place will have had some impact. I think the situation would probably be quite different if there was literally no policing on the French coast at all. The challenge is just that the numbers of people crossing have continued to be quite considerable despite everything that's going on.
Madeleine Sumption, interim chair of the government's Migration Advisory Committee. Thank you.
2 minutes to 8, time for the weather here, Stav.
Thanks very much, Nick and Justin. Good morning to you. It looks like high pressure's building in for the next couple of days. That'll settle the weather down nicely. It was very unsettled over the weekend. We had strong winds, quite a bit of rain at times. And we're starting today off rather blustery for many areas, particularly the northern half of the country. Much of Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern and East England will continue to see a few blustery showers over the next few hours, some containing hail, and there will be some snow on the hills, the North Pennines, and certainly across Scotland. But as we move into the afternoon, the showers become confined to northern and eastern Scotland, the northern Isles, where it does remain windy with further gales. But for the rest of Scotland, Northern Ireland, England and Wales, as high pressure begins to build in from the south and west, the winds will start to turn lighter from a west-northwesterly direction. So an improving sort of day with increasing amounts of sunshine as well for many into the afternoon. Many places turning drier temperature-wise, 9 to 12 degrees. That's around average for the time of year. Tonight, we see that area of high pressure building stronger. It will start to import some mild, moisture-laden air from the south. West. It'll bring a lot of cloud with it, and we could start to see some patchy drizzle across western hills, but temperature-wise, milder than when it's been the last few nights, 5 to 10 Celsius. So we start tomorrow off on a mild note, rather grey and cloudy for many, with further drizzle across western hills. Certainly western England, western Wales and western Scotland. But as we head through the afternoon, we'll start to see some breaks appearing in the cloud with some sunny spells and it'll turn very mild.
Stav, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 30th of March. The headlines this morning. President Trump has insisted negotiations with Iran are going extremely well and that more ships carrying oil will be going through the Strait of Hormuz.
We're doing extremely well in that negotiation, but you never know with Iran because we negotiate with them and then we always have to blow them up.
Oil firms, shipping companies and banks, as well as the military, are to take part in talks at Downing Street on the economic impact of the war. After the news, we'll be talking to a former deputy governor of the Bank of England about what that might mean for us all. And our final headline, Travelodge says it's looking at what more it can do to protect guests after a woman was sexually assaulted by a man who deceived staff to get into her room.
And coming up before 9 o'clock, and banning what the Prime Minister calls addictive algorithms protect children from the dangers of social media. And in the week where we're all watching out to see if NASA astronauts will make it back to the moon, we're looking at some of the finest examples of space-based reading materials for our Easter book club.
This is the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Perhaps the most remarkable, certainly the most successful book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor.
The BBC News read this morning by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said negotiations between the US and Iran about bringing the war to an end are going extremely well. He said that, as a sign of respect, up to 20 oil tankers would be allowed through the Strait of Hormuz. Mr. Trump has also told the Financial Times he doesn't think the Iranians would be able to defend Kharg Island, their main terminal for oil exports. The price of Brent crude remains high, trading at around $115 a barrel. From Washington, here's our correspondent Tom Bateman.
President Trump's claim that Iran was close to conceding to his demands came alongside a series of anonymous briefings from US officials about the apparent readiness of troops to carry out ground operations. Thousands of US Marines are now in the region with special forces and paratroopers on the way. The administration is making it known the president is considering anything from a raid on Iran's oil export terminal, Kharg Island, to an audacious but likely implausible operation to seize its stockpile of highly enriched uranium, which Mr. Trump calls Iran's nuclear dust. Speaking on Air Force One last night, he said Iran was ready to hand it over, and if not, it wouldn't have a country anymore. Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf, suggested Mr. Trump was using talk of negotiations as cover for planning a ground attack, saying Iran would not accept surrender and its men were waiting for the American soldiers to set them on fire.
In Australia, the government has approved measures to help with the cost of living, including halving duties on petrol and diesel for 3 months. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said he understood people were under severe pressure. Here, Sir Keir Starmer is to host business leaders at Downing Street to discuss the impact of the Iran war on the UK's economy. The Conservatives say VAT should be removed from domestic energy bills for the next 3 years. Our business editor, Simon Jack, reports.
Among those attending the meeting will be representatives from Shell, BP, the Lloyd's insurance market, as well as the shipping giant Maersk and banks such as Goldman Sachs and HSBC. There'll be a military briefing on the security situation in the Strait of Hormuz. Downing Street is describing it as a roundtable discussion on how the government and the private sector can work together to reduce the impact of the war on the cost of living. The Prime Minister will reiterate that the best way to do that is through de-escalation, but that is something the attendees have no control over. Separately, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will urge other G7 finance ministers to reduce their collective reliance on imported fossil fuels. Her solution is to press ahead with more renewables and nuclear. A different message than the opposition leader Kemi Badenoch will take to Scotland. She will put the emphasis on more North Sea oil and gas drilling, which she accepts may have little impact on prices, but may give you more jobs and tax revenue to spend on any interventions needed to help households.
The Israeli military says it's been carrying out more airstrikes on Iran, while the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered an extension of what he called the security zone in southern Lebanon. Tehran has also continued to fire missiles and drones at targets in Gulf countries. Kuwait says one person was killed in a strike on a power station and water desalination plant. The boss of Travelodge has said the hotel chain is looking at how it can make further changes to protect customers after a woman was sexually assaulted by a man who was given a key card to her room by staff. The attack happened in Berkshire in 2022. Last month, Kieran Smith, who's 29 and from Surrey, was jailed for 7.5 years. In an interview with BBC Breakfast, the chief executive of Travelodge, Joe Boydell, insisted guests were safe in its hotels.
Clearly we've made mistakes and I genuinely apologise to the victim for what happened to her and the way that we handled her case subsequently. It clearly wasn't good enough. That's why we've made some immediate changes and that's why we are taking a good long hard look at this in terms of an independent review to really thoroughly but urgently investigate what we need to change.
The victim, who can't be named to protect her anonymity, says she doesn't accept the apology.
They're only doing things as and when they need to, rather than actually thinking, actually, no, this is wrong. It's like they're taking slow steps to get to the right point, but they're not getting there fast enough. I feel like they should have realised the problem before this, and they shouldn't have made me feel so dismissed.
A gunman who'd been on the run in Australia since last August has been shot dead by police. Desi Freeman had been wanted for killing two police officers and seriously injuring a third in the state of Victoria. Police haven't said how they found him. Freeman, who was 56, described himself as a sovereign citizen, opposed to government and the law. Here's our Australia reporter, Simon Atkinson.
7 months ago, Desi Freeman vanished into a rugged national park after shooting three officers who'd arrived at his home with an arrest warrant. What followed was one of the country's biggest manhunts, with a $1 million Australian reward for information. Earlier this year, Victoria Police revealed they strongly believed Freeman was dead, but they hadn't entirely ruled out that he was being harboured or was hiding in the rough terrain, which detectives conceded he knew far better than them. Freeman was tracked to a property 110 miles from where he was last seen. Police say he was killed after refusing to surrender during a three-hour standoff. Investigations are now focusing on how he'd managed to escape and who, if anyone, had been helping him.
The final details of the compensation scheme for drivers' missold car finance agreements are being published by the Financial Conduct Authority. It has previously said 14 million deals could have led to overcharging. The average payout is expected to be around £700 per agreement. Our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey reports.
This is a significant moment in a long-running multi-billion pound saga. The FCA has previously suggested nearly half of car finance agreements made between 2007 and 2024 were unfair and are in line for compensation. Some discretionary commission arrangements between lenders and dealers, a practice that's now banned, left customers paying too much for loans. Today, the regulator will publish its final decision on a central compensation scheme that could total more than £8 billion. But lenders described earlier draft plans from the FCA as too broad and too generous. They and claims management companies may still challenge the regulator's final plan, leading to an even longer wait for payouts to begin.
A new child-focused approach to legal disputes between parents has been hailed as the most significant change to family courts in 30 years. The assessment has been made by Sir Andrew McFarlane, who's stepping down as the president of the Family Division. A pilot scheme is now being extended across England and Wales. Specialist lawyers have warned it may need more funding. Here's Sancha Berg.
Sir Andrew McFarlane said the new child-focused court turned the traditional approach to parental disputes on its head. Instead of starting with the parents' accounts, a case will now begin with the child. A social worker from the Children and Family Court Advisory Service, CAFCAS, will interview them and their parents and write a report for the family judge. Once in court, the parents will be urged to consider the impact their dispute is having and to agree a way forward, avoiding a lengthy court battle. Domestic abuse advisers will be there for support. The approach has been piloted for 4 years. It's now being used in 10 court regions. Sir Andrew McFarlane welcomed the government's decision to fund the scheme nationwide over the next 3 years. But the Association of Lawyers for Children warned far more money would be needed to achieve a genuine transformational change.
An incredibly rare Bronze Age shield found in North Ayrshire has returned to Scotland for the first time in more than 200 years. It had been presented to the Society of Antiquaries in London shortly after it was dug up in the late 18th century, but will now form part of a new exhibition in Edinburgh, as Rebecca Drought reports.
The bronze shield, which is more than 3,000 years old, was discovered near Beath in North Ayrshire in around 1779. It was found with five or six others, buried upright in a circle in the peat. It's decorated with a hammered boss and concentric circles and shows evidence of damage from a spear. The whereabouts of the others is a mystery. It's not known why the shields were buried in this way. Experts speculate the reason was ceremonial. Wooden or leather shields were more common in those times. Bronze ones were rare and symbolised the status of the warriors they belonged to. The Beath shield will sit alongside five or six others found in the 19th century for a new exhibition at the National Museum of Scotland.
That report was from Rebecca Drought.
Thank you, Alan. It is now 8:10. Keep calm and carry on. That is the message, the plea coming from government as fuel prices soar, food prices are beginning to reflect the shortage of fertiliser and the cost of borrowing for homeowners, and the government is on the rise. It forms the background to today's meeting in Downing Street, at which the Prime Minister will meet with shipping, finance, insurance leaders as he and his ministers draw up contingency plans to deal with the possibility of shortages of diesel and jet fuel. All around the world, governments are considering measures to cushion people from the economic impact of the war, which some are now beginning to argue could be even greater than the oil crisis of the early 1970s. Listen to Lars Jensen, a former director of the shipping giant Maersk and now the CEO of Vespucci Maritime, a container shipping consultancy, who spoke to us just a couple of hours ago.
Back then, the amount of goods, not just oil, but also fertilizer, aluminium, all sorts of other products, it was a lot less than what we're dependent on today. So the impact we are seeing today is going to be substantially larger than what we saw back in the 70s.
The immediate impact for many is the price of petrol, the price of diesel, the price of fuel. There have been moves in Ireland, in Poland, in Spain to cut the price by reducing fuel duty or cutting the VAT on fuel. And overnight, Australia joined that group. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced that the government there will halve fuel tax over the next 3 months to help to lower petrol prices.
While Australia's fuel supply outlook remains secure in the near term, we need to be very clear as well with Australians that the longer this war goes on, the worse the impacts will be. And I and the government understand that people are really worried, but we have a plan to get through this. We understand the cost pressures for people are very real as the impact of the war on the other side of the world plays out right here.
Well, here on the other side of the world, they also say that the fuel supply outlook remains secure. Petrol Retailers Association has said that petrol is flowing normally. People do not need to change their habits. There have, though, been warnings about interruptions to the supply of diesel and to jet fuel. On Saturday's programme, Nick Butler, former BP executive, advisor to Prime Minister Gordon Brown, told us the government needed a plan for the coming months.
A lot of countries around the world are now beginning to look at how you gently restrict consumption, driving alternate days for different registration numbers, having an extra day's holiday or a week. That's what some countries in the Far East are doing. Those sort of measures are a form of rationing that will constrain demand in order to bring a new balance with supply for as long as this goes on.
In a moment, we'll hear from the former chair of NatWest and former deputy governor of the Bank of England, Sir Howard Davis. First, a word with Simon Jack, our business editor. What do you think is now on the government here's agenda? Because so far, nothing much has shifted beyond that help for people dependent on oil for heating their homes, Simon. Do you think other measures are on their way?
Well, first to say, the UK is in a better position than a lot of the countries we've mentioned this morning in Asia and Australasia, because we get most of our crude oil from the US and Norway. But refined products, and you've mentioned them, diesel and jet fuel, are most affected because we tend to import the refined bit of that product. And we've seen that already in higher prices for diesel. It's up 26% versus unleaded petrol, which we refine more of, which is up only 15%. But as you say, there'll be increasing pressure, not just to delay a rise in fuel duty due in September, but to start cutting, particularly as the government, remember, is getting extra VAT revenue on the back of those higher fuel prices. Obviously, commercial operators will claim some of that back. But you're right, Bridget Phillotson over the weekend played down fears of impending fuel shortages. But there is, if necessary, and we're not there yet for the reasons I discussed, a national emergency plan for fuel. You have oil stock release. We've seen some of that already. You can designate filling stations for emergency and critical service vehicles, prioritise diesel to commercial vehicles, etc. As I say, not there yet, but the issue will be, should we be contemplating a rise in fuel duty, the first rise in many, many years, or should we be thinking about cutting, as we've seen,
isn't
for example,
the truth,
the 18th of Spain?
Yeah. There's not the faintest chance of them increasing fuel duty in September. Nobody thinks they're going to do that, is there? Poland reducing VAT on fuel from 23% to 8% and cutting fuel excise tax. Ireland cutting excise duty by the equivalent of 13p. Spain cutting VAT on fuel down from 21% to 10%. All the pressure's in the other direction, isn't it, to cut it?
Yeah, I think the idea of a fuel duty rise, even though it's not due to come in September, looks like a very remote possibility. And as you say, all the pressure is going the other way. And as I say, given the fact that they're getting extra VAT revenue on the 20% they put on top of, for example, petrol and diesel sales, there will be some extra money in the kitty to do that. So, yes, as you would say, the Treasury say, look, all of these things remain under review. But when you've got a morning when you're seeing all those moves around the rest of the world, as I say, the UK in a better position, and with fuel prices or crude oil, for example, up this morning is up another 3%. So that debate will only intensify.
And just a final thought just before we turn to Sir Howard. If we look at oil prices, what, about $116 a barrel? Remind us how far it's come just in four or five short weeks.
Well, we're up 50% on crude oil since hostility started. We started out around 72 barrels for Brent crude. We're currently at 108, if I'm looking at the chart correctly now. So that is a very significant rise. You've also seen gas price rises. And in a way, it's the gas price rise which can affect people's heating bills. Another reminder that rather weirdly, from next week, heating bills will go down because of the energy price cap, which will protect consumers. But the prices they'll pay after July are now in the system. And as I say, as this goes on longer, that noose, that tightening of supplies only gets tighter.
Simon Jett, thank you. Turning now to Sir Howard Davis. Good morning to you, Sir Howard.
Good morning.
All of what we've just heard is likely to increase pressures on ministers to, quote, do something. If you were in that meeting today wearing your old hat, either as a head of NatWest or indeed as Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, would you be tempted to say, well, actually, hold out, ministers, don't do something quite yet?
Yes, I think the problem is that while Simon Jack may think that the UK is in a better position than other countries, overseas investors in government bonds, in gilts, take a different view. So I hope that Simon's prepared to get his cheque out a bit later today and buy some gilts, because at the moment what we're seeing is that the increase in interest rates paid by our government has gone up much more than elsewhere. It's gone up by about twice as much as the US or Germany. And
just to be clear, Sir Howard, you're not contradicting Simon about where we get our oil from. What you're saying is that investors don't trust the state of our public finances and demand a very high price to lend us money. Is that right?
That's right. Obviously, on oil supply, yes, I think Simon is absolutely correct. But I think that the overall position of the UK, the financial markets are telling us, is not good, in that the confidence in our borrowing has gone down and the costs of our borrowing have gone up because people are concerned about our public finances. The increase in interest rates that has happened for us means about $12 billion a year additional interest payments. As you recall, the government's surplus is about $21 billion. That's the headroom they have in their fiscal plans. So this is eating up a lot of it. And any suggestion that the government's prepared to take the brakes off and splurge on public spending, I think, may result in even further increases in interest rates, which would leave you back where you started. So you've got to be very careful here.
Just address someone who doesn't spend their life worrying about bond markets and gilts and traders and so on. They might say, well, that's all very well, but I've got to pay to fill the car. I've got to pay to heat the house. Just give me some help.
Yes, well, the government appears to be talking about targeted help, and I think that's entirely justifiable. And politically, one can understand why they would need to do something like that. But I think that the types of scheme that have been done in the past, which have given benefits even to people like you and me, Nick, is not affordable at the present time. We have much less fiscal headroom, in other words, much less room for the government to spend more than we used to have. And they need to be very careful, because any suggestion that they're going to spend more on a big scale would, I think, be counterproductive.
Now, one of the reasons for that, presumably, is that the help that was given after COVID could be done because people knew that we would bounce back once the lockdown was over. There was no reason we shouldn't go back to what we were doing before. Comparisons are now being made with the 1970s, as we just heard. Is that the right sort of comparison? Is it really going to be as bad as that?
I think it probably is the right comparison. I think COVID is not a good model of what we need now, because, as you say, that looked as if it was going to be a V-shaped recession. Once we'd sorted out our vaccinations, we were probably going to be in the clear. In this case, it could well be that supplies from the Middle East are constrained for quite a long time, and therefore we may have to live with a higher oil price, perhaps not $150, but certainly higher than the 60 it was when we started, for quite a long period. That requires a plan to increase alternatives and also to reduce consumption, because it looks as though we may well have a long-term reduction in supply. So the sort of thing Nick Butler was talking about trying to find ways of reducing our energy consumption, will, I think, come very firmly on the agenda. And that sort of thing is happening elsewhere in the world.
And the argument that is being made by opposition parties, well, just drill now, would that help?
No. That's a political point scoring, which I can understand. But even what are called tie-in additional capacity, in other words, allowing drilling just next to existing wells, etc., is probably going to be 3 years before it comes on stream. And any new scheme is going to be more like 10 years.
And if, as you began this conversation by suggesting, Britain's biggest problem is nothing to do with oil, it's to do with our ability to borrow money, what can government do to make that better than the situation we currently face?
Well, they could join the euro, of course, because one thing you notice...
Talking things that are not going to happen, Sir Howard.
I'm sorry, is that off the agenda? I didn't realise
well,
the BBC
agenda,
banned
but I suspect
discussion of the euro.
Oh, no. I was merely suggesting it wasn't all that likely to happen in the short term, but please go ahead.
That's possibly true, but I mean, it's quite interesting that, you know, at the moment, we are paying about 1% more for our money than the Greeks. And the only possible explanation for that can be that they're part of this, you know, continental economy and a continental currency, which protects them to some degree. Now, I think that the government has to keep reiterating that we do have a fiscal plan that keeps our debt from rising significantly. And they do. I mean, obviously, they're getting political pain for that, but they do have a reasonable plan. Our budgetary position is actually significantly better than France, for example, because they are continuing to dig a hole by reducing pension ages and things like that. So our position is better. We've got to continue to reiterate that. But it does appear at the moment, unfortunately, that the markets are not hearing that message as loudly as they should.
If anybody from the Treasury wants to come on and contradict me and say there is a plan to join the euro, we look forward to putting them on before 9 o'clock in the meantime. So Howard Davis, thank you very much for that overview. Howard Davis, Chair of NatWest until a couple of years ago, and before that, Deputy Governor of the Bank of England.
23 minutes past eight is the time. Here's the Prime Minister on a visit to a school on Friday.
We are consulting at the moment on whether there should be a social media ban for under 16s. There are strong views on that either way, and we're looking at how that might or work, what the variations on it might be. We're also working on things like addictive algorithms in social media that try to keep adults and children on social media for a long time. Chatbots, which at the moment are not sufficiently controlled. We're passing a new provision to deal with that.
Well, we've talked a good deal about the issue of under-16s and social media, but the Prime Minister seemed to be suggesting as well that algorithms that the social media companies use to boost engagement for children and for adults as well, plus chatbots that the AI companies use to talk to us, might also face regulation. How realistic is that? Dr. Caitlin Regehr is Associate Professor of Digital Humanities at UCL, author of Smartphone Nation, and on the line, Bruce Daisley, former head of Twitter in Europe. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Talk to us first, Dr. Rigger, about what the algorithms are. At the moment, they are private, aren't they? We know that they exist. They are the rules used by the companies, but they don't make it clear to us what they are.
Yeah, and so part of this ask at the moment is around transparency. I think that it's worth noting that this is really coming about and on the back of what happened in California this week.
And that's the trial where it was found that a social media company, a couple of them actually, were liable for someone's for the effect that it had had on a woman as a result, she said, of being online.
Yeah, that's right. So it was called the Social Media Addiction Trial. And that attacked or questioned, we should say, the actual technological processes. So that trial was not about the right to publication, but rather the right to dissemination. So not whether someone has the right to post their suicide journey, but whether that suicide journey should be promoted to a child. That was what was at stake in that trial. And Meta and YouTube were found liable in that it was an addictive process and that hate, harm and disinformation was being prioritized because it's more attention grabbing.
Right. So, Bruce Daisley, if the government does want to crack down on algorithms, how realistic is it?
Yeah, I think there's a danger sometimes when we talk about these things that we imagine that there's an envelope, like the formula for Coca-Cola. There's an envelope that if we just suddenly opened it, we'd get all of the glorious algorithmic information. And you sort of got a sense from hearing the Prime Minister that he had four or five go-to phrases and words that he was dropping into what he was saying. Beware simple answers to complicated problems is always an important maxim here. Quite often, these algorithms are so sophisticated that no human themselves can understand it. And especially because we're in an era now, if you use Instagram's product Threads, you can say, update my algorithm, make it personal for me. And no human will have touched that. It will be simply based on the sort of fingerprint of the content you consume yourself. It's not an appalling idea to suggest that maybe young people could be given access to a product that is just reverse timeline. It's just the most recent posts come to you first. It's not a terrible idea to suggest that, but I think the suggestion that somehow government is going to solve the problem of algorithms can be a bit simplistic. It's a touch reductive.
He seemed to be suggesting, Dr. Reger, that you could single out algorithms that were particularly addictive from other algorithms.
I agree that is overly simplistic. There's also a real contradiction happening here where you have this same government saying we need more transparency around the social media algorithms that children are using, which at the same time they're saying that by the year 2027 they want to put AI tutors into all schools. And again, it's really unclear who's going to own that data. I mean, that's also going to be children's data that may be owned by a private company. So I think parents here often are voicing that there are mixed messages going on with this government, with its relationship to technology and its relationship to children's data.
Which, to be fair to them, Bruce Daisley, I mean, it's not just this government, is it? It's politicians writ large, and all of us, in a sense, as you make clear, we're struggling, actually, to keep up with things that human beings find difficult to understand.
Yeah, it's really interesting as well. Specifically, you know, in any normal discussion about things like this, we'd be talking about the revenue they were making, the fact that still now you can go onto YouTube and it's full of advertising targeting children. A lot of the toy advertising that once might have been on children's television has all migrated to YouTube. And it's interesting that the algorithms are taking so much of the headspace there. We're not even considering the moral conundrum of advertising to teenagers and to children. And that might be an added dimension. If we took away the financial incentive of these firms targeting these young people, conceivably, it might make the whole capture of young eyes and young minds less appealing to the big tech firms.
OK, well, for the time being, Dr. Caitlin Reger and Bruce Daisley, thank you. Meta and Google saying they disagree, of course, with the verdict on that trial. They are appealing as well. They say they're defending themselves vigorously. As every case is different, they remain confident in their record of protecting teens online.
Time at 29 minutes past 8 for Carthy in the sports.
Morning, thank you very much. 44 days and just 7 matches. That's how long Igor Tudor lasted as the interim head coach of Tottenham Hotspur. The BBC understands that Spurs want to convince Roberto De Zerbi to become their new permanent head coach. 19-year-old Kimi Antonelli has become the youngest driver to lead Formula One's World Championship after winning the Japanese Grand Prix. But the 4-time world champion, Max Verstappen, says he's considering his future in the sport after an 8th place finish in Japan and a frustrating start to the season. Tennis, and Jannik Sinner and Aryna Sabalenka have won the Miami Open singles titles to add to the Indian Wells titles they both won 2 weeks ago. It's only the fourth time in history that the same two players have won what's known in tennis as the Sunshine Double. I've just been speaking to Annabelle Croft, the former British number one who was commentating on the Miami Open, about why it is so hard to win the Indian Wells and Miami tournaments back to back.
I think because these events are really big events. They're sort of just underneath, you know, our Grand Slams in tennis. They contain most of the very best players in the world, unless some of them are injured. And also the conditions are very, very different between the two tournaments. So, you know, in Indian Wells, the conditions are lighter, the ball flies a bit more. People have described it as altitude, very, very hot, dry conditions. And then, you know, if you win that tournament, you've then got to make a huge adaptation to go to Florida, where the conditions are very, very different. The height of the ball is different, and the way that it bounces, the way it flies through the air. So it's a lot to contend with, but also just to do it back to back with the intensity of competition is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's a massive achievement for both of them. And the men's final wasn't straightforward. There were rain delays in Miami. Jannik Sinner, though, just isn't fazed by very much. Do you think that his big rival at the moment, Carlos Alcaraz, will be using Sinner's success to perhaps push himself a little bit more this year?
Well, I was looking back at his results last year, and he lost to Jack Draper in Indian Wells, and then he lost relatively early in Miami as well. But that pushed him on to then win a further seven titles in 2025, including the French Open. So, you know, I think the fact that he'd won the Australian Open, sometimes that takes so much out of a player. It just takes him a little bit of time to reset. It shows that he's human. But I think that you're right. I think him sitting back and watching Sinner do the Sunshine Double is definitely going to spur him on, and it's just going to make this rivalry between the two even more intense.
Yeah, it's great fun to watch, isn't it? And Aryna Sabalenka has also done the Sunshine Double after losing the Australian Open final at the start of the year. Was that maybe a bit of a spur for the run that she has gone on?
Well, she's a very clear number one at the moment. She's been unbelievably consistent. I think she's only, I believe, the fourth player this century to have reached a consecutive four finals in a season at the start of the season, which is quite extraordinary, I think. And she's also talked about the fact that her goal is to be putting her name in the history books. And so I think she definitely achieved that, you know, with winning the Sunshine Double this year. And I think it's for the rest of the players to try to keep up with her at the moment, because she not only has all that power on the court and that level of consistency and that huge serve, but we've seen her adding extra elements to her game with more slice backhands, more variety. We've seen her serve volleying a little bit more. So, you know, she's really always striving to improve her game, even though she's the very clear world number one.
Annabelle Croft, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And just a couple of other headlines for you. Rugby Union Prem champions Bath had a 31 points to 26 win over Sale, meaning Bath are just 1 point behind leaders Northampton Saints now. And in Rugby League's Super League, Warrington Wolves' 100% record is over after a 26 points to 22 defeat to Leeds Rhinos.
Cathy, thank you. Today's start of the week is looking back 100 years. Here is Tom Sutcliffe to tell us more.
Morning, Nick. Morning, Yeah, Justin, yeah. Sorry.
Whatever.
We're going to give listeners a break from current anxieties about societal breakdown and supply chain apocalypses and the crisis of democracy by talking about all those things 100 years ago, when the general strike of 1926 brought this country to the brink of civil war. So many people feared. The fascinating story of what actually happened, from submarines in the Thames to John Betjeman's brief enlistment in the workers' struggle, is the subject of David Torrance's book, The Edge of Revolution. And joining him to talk about the lasting aftershocks of the strike and the changing face of work today are Jane Holgate, Professor of Work and Employment Relations at the University of Leeds, and Isabel Berrick, the Financial Times specialist on the future of work. We're calling on everybody to down tools at nine and listen.
And Winston Churchill tried to take over the BBC, as I recall.
Yeah, Mussolini Major, as he was known.
Ah, that and more with Tom after 9 o'clock. Look forward to that. Quick look at the weather. Can we look forward to that? Well, the north is going to see scattered showers in the morning. Further south, mostly dry with sunny spells in the morning.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson, Justin Webb. The time is just coming up to 25 to 9. Alan Smith has the news.
President Trump has said the US could reach a deal with Iran fairly quickly and that Tehran's leaders were being very reasonable in talks. Israel says it's been carrying out new waves of attacks in Iran and has ordered its military to move further into southern Lebanon. The Prime Minister is meeting leaders from the energy, shipping and finance sectors to discuss the economic impact of the war. The closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the targeting of energy infrastructure has caused oil prices to soar in recent weeks. Sir Howard Davies, a former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, told this programme the UK may have to live with higher prices for some time in the face of long-term reduction of supply. The boss of Travelodge says the hotel chain will look at how it can better safeguard their guests after a man deceived staff to get a woman's key card and then sexually assaulted her. Joe Boydell apologised to the victim and said a full independent review was underway. And the Financial Conduct Authority will publish the final details of the compensation scheme for drivers who have missold car finance agreements. The regulator has previously said 14 million deals could have led to overcharging.
Thank you for that. It is just after 25 to 9. Where are the joint Arab and Islamic institutions, chief among them the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, while our countries and peoples are subjected to this treacherous Iranian aggression? So asked the Emirati Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed a day or two ago on X. Let us get an answer for him from Hossam Zaki of the Arab League, who is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What is going on at the moment when it comes to the defence of the Gulf countries, diplomatically and I suppose potentially as well militarily? They feel, don't they, at least some of them, that they've been let down by the Arab League. Have they been?
This is quite a sensitive matter, as you can imagine. Mm. Listen, we have two ways of achieving some kind of defense when one of our member states is under attack. One has never really been activated, but there is a treaty in this regard that dates back to the 50s that has not been activated, unfortunately, throughout these years for a variety of reasons. And the other one is political and diplomatic. And I claim that the political and diplomatic position that have been adopted by the Arab League since day one has been nothing but perfect. And we've been doing whatever it takes, whatever was needed in order to support the positions of the attacked states and explain worldwide and in international fora what the danger is about and the danger coming from Iran is about. And we have been very vocal about that. So
have you, just to be clear about that,
an unfair accusation.
Yeah, if it is an unfair accusation, then is it in your view, is it clear that the Arab League has condemned openly what Iran has done?
Openly, unequivocally, irreversibly, from day one. The statements, both of the Secretary General, on February 28th, when the attacks had begun, and then the Council of the Ministers, which is basically like the board of this league, composed of all member states, all 22 member states, have done so. And we've both been reading from the same book, basically. So I don't know exactly what is meant when accusations like these are flying around, but I'm aware of them. We are all aware of them. We read them in social media and in some of the newspapers and sites and so on. But when there was a meeting, yesterday there was a meeting, I think ministers who gathered in the video conference meeting, I think everybody spoke the same language. And it was very clear that there is no exception. And we issued a statement yesterday, a very, very strongly worded statement against Iran and against what Iran has been doing. And without any exception or any reservation from anybody.
One of the things that seems to have upset some of the Gulf states, and they're not all speaking with one voice in this, but some of the Gulf states that have expressed concerns seem to be upset about the way some of the local media in, for instance,
Algeria, in Egypt, have treated what Iran has done. So in other words, when Iran attacks Israel, they seem perfectly happy with that, and they kind of don't report at all, this is the accusation, on the bigger number of attacks that have taken place against the Gulf states.
Well, in that, I have to be very unequivocal, and I say that they are right. First of all, we need to understand that all these countries, the attacked countries, are living the stress of war day by day. And that is weighing very strongly on their emotions, on their declarations, and so on. So that is something that needs to be understood. The second thing, well, yes, if there is a media outlet in the whole Arab world that is dealing in this way, I say it is doing wrong. And I say it needs to take another look at its positions, because our primary goal is to stand with our Arab brethren in such a very difficult time. Mm. The attacks by Iran is putting tremendous stress on those attack states, in particular in the Gulf states and Jordan, and also in Iraq.
Okay, well, you've been very clear with us this morning. Hossam Zaki, we appreciate your time. Hossam Zaki is Assistant General Secretary of the Arab League. Thank you.
Time now is 19 minutes to nine. The family court deals with some of the most sensitive, controversial, difficult cases in our justice system. Bitter court disputes between parents involving, in the last year, almost 60,000 children in England alone. The most senior judge in the family court, Sir Andrew McFarlane, is stepping down today. He's promoted what he's called the most significant change in 30 years, new child-focused family courts. And our reporter Sancha Berg has been talking to him. Over recent years, you will have heard Sancha's reports using new transparency rules to follow what happens in a little understood, a little known part of our justice system. And Sancha joins us in the Today studio. Morning to you, Sancha. I say not understood and not known, but it is vital, isn't it?
Well, it is, because it's the most important part of people's lives. It's children and what's going to happen to them. So most cases in the family court are what are called private law cases. That's where you've got parents who are arguing over what should happen to their children. They can't agree. They end up in the family court. And with the current system, it can be a really difficult, prolonged, really painful process, because more and more parents don't have access to lawyers, thanks to cuts to legal aid. So they're trying to put forward their own case without any help. And these battles can drag on literally for years. I'm currently following one for File on 4 Investigates, which has lasted almost all of a six-year-old girl's life. As you can imagine, this is really traumatic for the children. So what this new approach does is it starts with the child. A guardian, that's a CAFCAS social worker, the Children and Courts Family Advisory Service, will meet the child, meet the parents, draw up a report for the judge, and the judge will have that before anybody even gets to court. So as Sir Andrew explained to me, it's a very different thing.
And the question at the hearing is not what's this case about, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, because the judge knows from the report. The judge will say, is this what's going on? Well, look at the impact on your child of what you two are doing. What are we going to do to make things better? What are we going to do in the future for this child?
So it's a very different approach, a problem-solving approach that requires more resources, particularly from CAFCAS. Are you confident it can be done within a reasonable time frame, the 3 years that are being talked about by the government?
I am, because we've done it. We've got it live in 10 courts now, and we've achieved it in that same sort of time frame for those courts.
But not everyone is as confident as Sir Andrew. I have to say, the Association of Lawyers for Children told me that what was needed for genuine transformative change was a very different level of investment in legal aid, in CAFCAS, in the whole family court system. Now, Sir Andrew is retiring. Some judges in his position have continued to hear cases when they've stepped down. He's decided to give it up completely. Over the course of a long career, he's decided some incredibly difficult cases. And I asked him, did he ever find it hard to sleep at night?
It's certainly challenging, but it's challenging at all levels of the family court. You're dealing with human relationships and the welfare in the future of the people who are in front of the court. And so it is challenging. But I think if you ask the same question of a trauma surgeon who's dealing with appalling injuries every day, I'm sure they can shut themselves off when they walk out of the operating theatre. And I think all professionals who work in family justice get used to protecting themselves to a degree from what goes on. But equally, you couldn't do the job if you didn't have enormous empathy for the individuals in front of you. So it's a difficult tightrope to walk. You've got to be emotionally connected enough to understand what's going on, but protected so that you aren't drawn in to the emotional fallout yourself.
So, Sergio, he's no longer walking that tightrope, but the reforms that he's advocated in this interview with you and for so long, they continue.
Well, that's right. There's the child-focused family court, which is we've been talking about and is going to be expanded. But, of course, there is also the transparency that he brought in that has enabled us to get a completely new perspective on family courts because, as journalists, for the first time, we've been able to report what we see and hear and crucially, talk to parents. So until Sir Andrew came, just to talk to parents could put you potentially in contempt of court. So it's a really significant change.
Sandra Burke, thank you.
And that brings us to 14 minutes to nine. An incredibly rare Bronze Age shield has been returned to Scotland for the first time in more than 230 years. The shield was discovered near Beath in North Ayrshire in around 1779. It was then presented to the Society of Antiquaries in London, where it's been ever since. So it is being loaned back, which is an extraordinary achievement for National Museums Scotland. And their senior curator of prehistory, Dr. Matthew Knight, is on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
And it's going to be quite something, isn't it, for people to be able to see and be able to see locally?
Yeah, it's a really, really important object. These were highly decorated objects, generally considered to be symbols of ceremony or status, but we've also been able to show that they're very effective defence weapons as well.
Describe the shield for us. How big is it? What does it look like?
The shield is about 60 centimetres in diameter. It's a round shield hammered from a single ingot of bronze into a very, very thin sheet, but then it's been decorated with concentric rings and concentric hammered bosses, and there's over 9,000 of these bosses hammered into the surface of the shield.
Does it look as if it's been used in anger or in self-defense?
Yeah, this is the really fascinating thing about this shield in particular, is you can really clearly see where a prehistoric sword or spear has pierced this shield at some point. So they were definitely used in combat, and this is really significant as well because these are some of the very early origins of conflict and violence in Britain.
When are we talking about? What year? Do you have a sense of when the shield was created and what sort of people were, what the conflicts were that were driving its use?
So the shield dates to just over 3,000 years ago in what we call the Bronze Age. And this is a period where people are settled in farming communities, they're living off the land. But this is also a period where we see the invention of the sword, the first object in human history that's designed purely for harming another human, unfortunately. And with this, if somebody has a sword, you want a shield or you want a bigger sword. And it fuels what I call the Bronze Age arms race, where you have societies coming into conflict with each other in a very dedicated fashion for the first time. And this gives rise to a sort of status with a warrior, somebody capable of defending your community, but also, unfortunately, shattering another.
Okay, so if people in Scotland want to see it, what should they do? Where is it going to be?
So it's been loaned to us, thankfully, by the Society of Antiquaries in London, and it's going to be on exhibition in Edinburgh from the 27th of June 2026 in Scotland's First Warriors.
Dr. Matthew Knight, Senior Curator of Prehistory at the National Museum of Scotland. Thank you.
It is now 11 minutes to nine. He's become the Liz Truss of the Premier League. Igor Tudor, the manager of Tottenham Hotspur, lasted just 44 days. Shorter time than the famous lettuce. And that matters, because Tudor was hired to stop something that was unthinkable at the start of the football season, relegation for one of the great names of the game, so that next season the mighty Spurs in their magnificent new North London stadium could be playing the likes of Oxford United or Swansea City. Unless, that is, the new man they hire in the days to come can turn things round. Let's reflect on that with a man who spends his life covering Spurs for The Athletic, Jack Pitt-Brook, and with Gary Madbutt. Famous player for the team, played 619 games in total for Tottenham. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning.
Gary, is it too late?
Well, actually, in your last item, Nick, if you could borrow that shield, if it's a defensive shield, it'd be great for the next seven games.
Yeah, just don't let some goals in and score some and you win the game.
But no, obviously, we're in a situation now whereby these next seven games are the most important games in this club's recent history. We got ourselves into this situation. No point in discussing how or why we've got there, but this is what we are. And we have to fight to get out of it. It's a tough fight at the bottom. It could go to the wire. But these players need somebody to come in. And I believe in this squad of players. Despite it's easy to go and pick faults, pick problems, what's gone wrong this season, and look for excuses. Everyone looks for excuses. You can say changing board, changing, it's been the third manager coming in this season, new players coming in, key players out injured. Lots of excuses, but there's no need for excuses now. We're in a situation whereby we have to get points, and I believe this squad is more than capable, when they're at their best, of getting those points.
Now, Gary, having been a player, you know that if someone comes in now, if anybody wants the job, that is, I suppose there's always a price, how do you turn things around at that speed? What is it you can say to players that make them start to play better than they have been?
Players are very stoical. Generally, they deal with things that happen, whether it be players' injuries, things going on within the club, change of managers. And that's something I think which comes quite naturally to players, because it happens quite often. Somebody's got to come in there, look at the situation, look at the players, know what's been happening at the club. And if I'm being totally honest, the group of players that we have available are more than capable of getting us out of the situation. Now, personally, the most important fact I think that the manager coming in has to actually deal with is the motivation of these players. These players have been going out on the field of play at times, in my opinion, not totally realising what their role on the field of play is. Come in with a very simplistic tactical plan that the players know their roles within that plan and get the players motivated to go out there and to make sure they 100% effort, desire, determination and passion. And I believe that should be enough to get us the points we need.
Well, there's the brief for the job, Jack Pitt-Brook. Is there anybody looking like they might want to take it?
I think the hardest thing that Tottenham have to face at the moment is that it's not an attractive job. It's not, you know, it takes a very brave man to jump aboard a sinking ship. And with only seven games to go, I worry that lots of managers don't want the relegation of Tottenham Hotspur on their CV. And it's basically a worse version of the issue they faced in February when they appointed Igor Tudor. And that's why they're having to cast the net so wide to try and find someone who will take the job.
And the same men making the appointment who made that appointment.
Yes, so it's been, Vinay Venkatesham and Johan Langer are very much the public face of this season, the CEO and sporting director. Obviously, ultimately, the buck stops with the Lewis family, the majority shareholders. And frankly, since their decision to dismiss Daniel Levy as chairman in September, it's just been disaster after disaster on the pitch. So there is a huge amount of pressure on the Tottenham hierarchy at the moment.
Now, you're paid to care, Jack. Gary clearly cares. I care about football. There are some listeners, even perhaps some presenters of this programme, who are not all that bothered what happens in the Premier League. Just give people a sense of the significance of Tottenham Hotspur going down, if, and it is still an if they were to do so.
Well, Tottenham have been in the top flights since the mid-1970s. They are kind of generally the fifth or sixth biggest and most successful team in the Premier League. They are a huge brand around the world. They've had some of the best players of the 21st century, you know, Harry Kane, Gareth Bale, Luka Modric, Son Heung-min have all played for them. They won the Europa League last year. They're a huge team in the Premier League and around the world. And so if Tottenham were to be relegated from the Premier League, I think it would be as significant, as unlikely as when Leicester City won the Premier League in 2016. It would be a seismic event in English football.
Although, of course, that did happen. Jack Pitbrook of The Athletic, Gary Mabber of Tottenham, always of Tottenham. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
6 minutes to nine is the time. Just a word to say over on Radio 3. John Toll is playing the first movement of Sibelius's Fifth Symphony, which is a piece, Nick, that I always believe contains rare musical moments that promise to make you sit up straighter and feel the air change around you. That, at least, is what it says here.
Brilliantly put, if I could say so. Look, in the last few minutes of that program, where you ponder whether to change channels or stick with Start the Week here on Radio 4, we're going to reflect again, as we have in the last 3 hours, on Artemis 2, on that space launch that is due to happen later this week, and to reflect for our Easter book club on books about space. And we're joined, as we always are, to talk about books by Frank Cottrell Boyce, the children's laureate and novelist, and Catherine Rundell, author of both children and adult literature. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Now, you're going to pick, Catherine, for us some books about space, starting with one of Frank's.
Yes, so Frank must cover his ears, because my favourite book set in space is Cosmic by Frank Cottrell Boyce. It's the story of an unusually tall 12-year-old boy who already shaves, who manages to win a ticket to a space park, posing as his friend Florida's father, and accidentally they end up orbiting the moon. And it has this exquisite moment in which they look down at Earth and they see the breathtaking loveliness of our planet. And it's funny and surreal and perfect for the 12-year-old in your life.
Follow that, Frank. You're not going to pick one of Catherine's, though.
Just keep going.
What would be on your list, Frank?
I think anyone my age wishes they were an astronaut, so I've chosen kind of the opposite. It's Jamie Drake Equation by Christopher Edge, which is a brilliant, he writes really brilliant sort of short, punchy books that are full of ideas. The Jamie Drake Equation takes its name from the Drake Equation, which is a way of working out the probability of life on other planets. And Jamie's dad is an astronaut, and Jamie just misses him and tracks him and realizes as he's tracking him that he might be in incredible danger and only Jamie knows. So it's full of emotion and bursting with ideas. It's a really short book, but like one of the books I think we're going to mention, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's full of ideas.
Well, ideas is what makes this literature so fascinating, isn't it, Catherine? Because in a way, there's a sense of infinite possibilities, isn't there? There are big themes that space opens up.
Exactly. And so for something like Hitchhikers, which I know you've been playing this morning, it is, of course, one of the finest comedies ever written. You know, the story of Arthur Dent, the last surviving Earthman. But it is also about philosophy, about community, about disaster, about how we rise to the events that are thrust upon us. You know, Adams died at the age of 49 and he was taken far, far too young. But in that time, he managed to create an extraordinary body of work, which is both incredibly funny, but also inquisitive about what makes us human.
And worth, Frank, a new generation accessing, because people of your and my age remember vividly when it first came out, but there'll be young people who would love it now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always seems extraordinary to me that from Kitty Hawk to Apollo, it's about 50 years. Mm. And and nothing's really happened since. So, it seems like a dream to them. It's that we thought we were growing up in the space age, and it turned out we weren't.
Yes. Well, maybe Optimus 2 will open up lots of possibilities. Yeah, we're hearing early on the programme. Exactly. Give us a couple of other choices then, Frank.
I've gone for a children's picture book, which it's not set in space. I've gone for Oliver Jeffers' Here We Are, which is the children's picture book equivalent of that amazing Earthrise photograph that was taken by Bill Anders on Christmas Eve in 1968, which completely changed the way we look at the world. And Here We Are is a book that Oliver Jeffers wrote for his son while he was waiting for his son to be born. And it's a kind of welcome to the planet. It's gorgeously illustrated, and it's a kind of a view of planet Earth and how to cope with it.
And Catherine, you have got a picture book for us as well.
Yes, Look Up by Nathan Byron with pictures by Dapo Adeola. It's a wonderful story of a little girl called Rocket who is desperate to make everyone in her town look up and see the oncoming Phoenix meteor shower. But her brother refuses to get off his phone, and it's the story of her inspiration by Mae Jemison, who is the first African-American woman in space. It is beautiful for a four-year-old or a six-year-old.